If everyone could sign in, that would be great. Up there on the table, there are refreshments. So please help yourself. Some say it's hot in here. There are drinks in the coolers.
It's hot in here.
I didn't know that was him, and somebody mentioned, like, he comes from that background. But, like, I don't think he really might come from that region, but not that background.
Just wanted to make a little announcement. We are going to get started here in a few moments, but we do know there's a board member who is a few minutes away, so we're going to give them a couple more minutes to get here. So feel free to continue your conversation, and we'll get started in a minute.
But if you could say Clinton, yeah, maybe, probably not Biden, it was years ago.
All right, everyone, we will now call to order this evening's study session of the Champaign County Mental Health Board, Wednesday, August 20th, 5:45 p.m. in the Shields Carter Room of the Bennett Administrative Center, Urbana, Illinois. May I have a roll call?
James Brandel.
Here.
Elaine Palencia.
Here.
John Paul Joachim.
Here.
Chris Miner.
Here.
Emily Rodriguez. Tony Nichols. Kyle Patterson, Molly McClay.
Here. All right, we do have a quorum this evening, so we can move on to approve the agenda. Would anyone like to have any discussion or motions about our agenda?
I make a motion to approve the agenda as presented.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Oh, okay. We do actually have an amendment that we need to make to change the order of the speakers. So under the study session portion, our second speaker will go third and our third speaker will go second. Any objections? It has been discussed in advance. All right. Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the agenda as amended, say aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. The ayes have it. The agenda is approved as amended. Next, we will move to public participation agency input. As always, members of the community are welcome to come to the Mental Health Board to speak with us about your concerns. This is a little bit of a different meeting than usual because we are having a study session to discuss some specific topics, and there will be like an open community discussion as part of that. So people are welcome to make public comment now, and there will be a portion at the end, but our kind of larger community discussion about resources and concerns of LGBTQIA plus community members kind of will occur sort of in the middle. The bulk of the meeting will be that. So folks who are here, please know that that is an opportunity to speak. Our public participation is something that we have designated components at each of our meetings for. So I do just want to mention during this part of the meeting, if anybody comes up to share with us, we cannot respond directly. We also can't ask questions, but we can use this to inform future decisions. And if anybody wants to come up and speak, they can either approach the podium, fill out a little comment card, and we'll call upon you later. Or if you're online, you can put something into the chat or raise your hand, and we can call upon you. I just want to mention for agency representatives and others providing input to be aware of the Illinois Lobbyist Registration Act and take steps to be in compliance with the act if speaking with us. I may limit individual time to 5 minutes and total time to 20 minutes. So with that, is there anybody who would like to speak now with the board? All right. Seeing none, we will move on. But again, this most of this study session will be an opportunity for the community to discuss things with us. And there will be a designated component for other public input later as well. So we will now move on to chairperson's comments. So my name is Molly McClay. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm the chair of the Champaign County Mental Health Board. And it's my honor to welcome you all here this evening for a very important conversation. Just a little bit about the Mental Health Board. We have five of us here tonight. We actually do have a new member that is pending appointment tomorrow at the county board meeting, and we will have a little moment to introduce him in a moment. We are all here appointed by the county from the community to help with disseminating our mental health resources here, including the funding that we receive from taxpayer dollars. And it's really important to us to understand the needs and the priorities of the community so that we can best determine how to use this like very large pool of money that we are so grateful to have available in this county, $6 to $7 million to give to mental health and substance use, as well as developmental disabilities. We have one of the best, most robust, and I would like to say best mental health boards in the state. And we have these study sessions time and again to really hear from the community about things that we should address. And I know that right now, more than over the last 6 months, especially, but for many, many years and decades, we have had the LGBTQIA plus community has been discriminated against. There's been homophobia and transphobia rampant, and right now more than ever before, direct policy attacks at the federal level. And we are here as part of our community to do what we can to support the needs of our community members and of all LGBTQIA people. And so that's why we're having this discussion this evening, to really hear from all of you, to know what we could consider for the future to make sure that we are prioritizing and centering the needs of this very important community. So that's a little bit about how the mental, what the mental health board is, and why we're why we called this meeting, or study session, I should call it. It's not an official meeting, and that just means we won't be voting on anything other than the agenda. But we are very excited to hear from everyone who's here this evening. I guess this is a good opportunity to introduce our new member who's pending appointment. So, Lynn, I will defer the rest of my comments to you to introduce our new member.
Well, I was thinking that I might, in turn, defer to the new member who's on the Zoom to introduce himself. Dr. Gomez, do you mind doing that, knowing that you are going to be appointed tomorrow? This is to replace Joe Omosage, who has resigned from the board prior to the end of the term. Anyway, you ready?
No problem. So hello, everyone. My name is Alejandro Gomez, and I have been living here in the Champaign-Urbana area for the last 25 years, and I currently work at the University of Illinois. I've worked at the university for the last 13, 14 years or so, and I have a varied background, which I think will lend itself nicely to my service in serving on the board. But first and foremost, I would be remiss if I did not mention my licensed clinical social work background and training. I've worked for about 20 years as a licensed clinical social worker and therapist, historically working many, many years at the Counseling Center at the Urbana-Champaign campus there at the university. In addition to other establishments and agencies within the Champaign-Urbana area. And so I look very much forward to working with you all.
Thank you so, so much. We're so excited to have you as part of the board. All right, with that, I conclude my comments, and we will next move on to comments from our staff, which today will come from Leon Bryson.
Thank you, and it's my pleasure to see all of the familiar faces that I have hounded via email to get here. So thank you from the bottom of my heart. I am Leon Bryson. I'm the Associate Director for the Champaign County Mental Health Board, and I use the pronouns he, him, his. Today's study session is the conclusion of weeks of planning, conversations, back and forth emails between CCMHB staff and presenters, technological obstacles as we strive to be inclusive of all, and most importantly, continued dedication from our guest speakers and program participants. During this study session, you will learn about LGBTQIA plus community resources and concerns, including discrimination, culture, sexual and gender identity, health, housing, and other social issues. I am honored to introduce our first speaker. Joshua Gavel is a dedicated advocate and community leader who has served Uniting Pride in multiple roles over the past 2.5 years, including operations manager, associate director, and now the interim executive director. Through collaborative leadership, he has seen the strengthening of the organization's programs, partnerships, and advocacy across East Central Illinois. A Champaign County native, Josh brings experience in nonprofit management, development, public education, and grassroots organizing, and is committed to building a more just and joyful future for the LGBTQ plus communities. Without further ado, Josh, the podium is yours.
sometimes our mics take a little bit to warm up, so we will give you a warm microphone.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Well, hello, everyone. First and foremost, I just want to say thank you for having us here. It is really an honor to be a partner of CCMHB and a funded organization. This means a lot to us to be able to be participating in conversations like this. Like Leon said, I am a Champaign County native. I've seen this organization over the last 15 years, and it's really a true honor to get to lead it for even a short period of time. So I just want to kind of start out and give an overview of Uniting Pride. As you can see in the board packet, our little PowerPoint, I know mine did not translate very well to PDF, so I'm sorry. but we are your local queer resource center. We are the 501c3 organization that serves not just Champaign County, but all of East Central Illinois, despite being an incredibly affirming state with a lot of wonderful protections and support. When you get into downstate, there are only 4 staffed brick and mortar resource centers. So between our little agency of 4 staff members, 3 right now, we serve about a dozen counties directly. In the last year, we saw nearly 500 program participants from dozens of counties across the state. And have gotten to work with quite a few people in this community. So Uniting Pride was founded in 2010. We're entering we're mid 15 years now. You may have remembered us in Lincoln Square Mall at Pride Fest, and now we shut down Urbana as the largest Pride Festival in the state of Illinois, outside of Chicago. But we've grown into a well-rounded resource center that provides services for hundreds of clients every year of all ages. Truly, we have programs for 0 to as old and wise as you can be. And we lead in the creation of a community where all who hold historically and actively marginalized gender and sexual identities can live fulfilling, joyful, healthy, and vibrant lives. Next slide. Our programs and services. We tend to put our programs and services into these 6 categories. Youth and family programs, including support groups and social groups for 0 to 10, 10 to 13, and then 14 to 18. Those groups also have, the older group has an online social space that is monitored by trained facilitators and gives youth a safe space to go online and communicate. We have a parenting group that is in an interesting flux right now. We were finding that we were getting 2 very different groups of parents who were interested in this program. Parents who were very much on the team, very much had done the work, were queer themselves maybe, and they were looking for a social space. And then we had parents that were like, my kid came out, whether it's a young kid or their adult kid, I don't know what to do. I've heard every horrible thing that you can hear, every bad stereotype. I just know I want to support my kid, but I've got to purge some of this stuff that I've heard and unlearn it. So we're really leaning into that group right now because we believe at the end of the day, the best advocacy that we can do as an organization is around education. So we're partnering with Dr. Violeta Rodriguez and her team at the Clinical Psych Department with the university to develop a monthly module-based training program that will address different modules each month, different issues, whether that's pronoun use or, you know, dispelling myths around identity, explaining the difference between sexual orientation and gender identity. And we're kind of relaunching that program this fall. We have also added a new program in partnership with the Stevens Family YMCA. Our Camp Kaleidoscope was in its 2nd year this year and saw over 25 youth from the area. And we have been able to do this day camp for 2nd to 5th graders and then 6th to 9th graders in a secure location. A private donor has provided a space for us to be able to take youth out into a safe space where they don't have to worry about, you know, someone heard the YMCA is doing a queer camp, we're going to go protest or we're going to go make it uncomfortable, which we did encounter this year. The Daily Wire, Ben Shapiro's news network went after us in the YMCA, and we had to take extra precautions. And it was a serious concern that we had. But the camp went out went off without a hitch. We had some really incredible feedback, some great testimonials from our participants and their families, and we're really, really excited to continue this program. Our other large youth and family program that we do every year is the Teen Queer Prom. So this is a prom-like dance that is for community members 13 to 18 from all over the state. It's the only Teen Queer Prom in this region that is completely free, that we pay, we get their clothes, we bring in food, we will pay for transportation if they need transportation, whatever it takes to get them there and get them into a safe space where they can have an affirming environment to, you know, do what is a normal rite of passage for high schoolers and teenagers. So our other programs, we have our adult support and social groups. We have advocacy programs that we do around education and resource connection. Various community events, which you have, I'm sure have heard of, Pride Fest, Love Fest. And then we have some needs-based services like our food pantry, our binder program, clothing closet, and queer library. And then, of course, everything comes back to education and connecting to community resources. So if we can go to the next slide. Or I actually talked about the youth and family programs. We can go down to queer prom. So like I said, Queer Prom is unique. It's the only completely free 13 to 18 queer dance in the area. And you can talk to any of my incredible team here tonight and any volunteers who have ever been to this event. It's truly one of the most heartwarming and wonderful events we get to do each year. The kids always come away with just joyful smiles and a great experience. But the volunteers and the adults come away, and we have heard some of our like most heartwarming and emotional testimonies from adults who have participated and helped us support this program, because so many of us did not get to have this opportunity when we were growing up. I went to Unity High School, and I certainly did not get to take my queer partner or my friends or people in my social circle in the way that I wanted to. If we had had queer prom back then, life would have been extremely different. So if you want to jump to the adult social and support groups one, we have several groups for adults, including several social groups. We have a crafting group. We have a general meetup group that meets the second and fourth Sundays of every month. And that's just a space where folks can come and gather, grab a coffee, talk. Sometimes they'll play board games. That's open to any queer community members who want to join it. We have a writing group. And some of these groups, it's really interesting. Crafted Up and Upwards, the writing group, both came from community members saying like, hey, I'm so passionate about doing this. I think it would be great to see this space. Like, can I help you create it? The writing group meets every Sunday, and whether you're writing a research paper or you're writing your novel or your fan fiction, it's a really wonderful, supportive space where you can go and share and get feedback in a judgment-free zone. We have a partnership with the Champaign Forest Preserves outside in Champaign Forest, which is a hiking group every second Saturday of the month. Chelsea Prawl, if you know her over at the Forest Preserve, she takes folks out to Homer Lake and Lake in the Woods and Middle Fork and all of these wonderful forest preserves and areas to do hiking and engage in the outdoors, which can often feel like spaces that we're not invited into. There are often times where we don't feel like we can go and be outdoorsy or get to fish or do, you know, normal outdoor stuff. And they came to us and said, let's start this program and make it a safe space. And it's really, really cool. It's been around for a year now. Our support groups, we have Aging Up, which is an elder support group. That is an every Sunday meeting, and it's always on Zoom, so it is COVID safe. It's safe for people who might have chronic illnesses or may not be able to travel well. And that is a space where self-identified elders can join, and we don't put an age limit on it. If you feel like a queer elder, join the group and make some fabulous friends. And that group has also turned into a cool program we do at Pride every year, which is Living History. So we'll bring together queer folks in the community who have been doing the work or who have really interesting stories to tell and give an intergenerational space for people to engage and hear firsthand about our history. so much of our history was lost over the last few decades, and we are now at a great turning point, I think, where we're seeing queer elders that we would not have seen 20, 30 years ago. And there's a lot of history there that younger generations need to learn and understand so that we can continue to fight and move forward. As you said, Molly, at the beginning, we're kind of in a backslide of policy and social stigma. This organization has seen a lot of incredible things over the last 15 years, but now we're back in the fight that we have to continue to dig deep, and we need to understand our history to do that. Trans Up is a trans and gender nonconforming support group that meets every Tuesday, and it alternates Zoom and in person. So it gives people an opportunity who can't necessarily travel to engage. Also, our two youth groups, Talk It Up and Queries, do the same. They alternate Zoom and in person. So even if a youth cannot get to us in person, they can get to us online. We have Lift Up, which is a paused group right now, but we're bringing it back this fall, which is just an open queer support space. We're excited to bring that back after Pride Fest. And then we have our Discord. So Discord, if you are not familiar with it, is a social platform that is popular in the gaming community, but it has gotten more popular in just the general community. It's kind of a hearkening back to the message board days. And our Discord has over 800 people who actively engage with it every month. It has dozens of channels, everything from sharing your artwork to sharing mutual aid to discussing, you know, what UP is up to, what other community partners are up to, sharing resources, and keeping people up to date on what is going on in our community. We have a lot of people who engage with that program who are moving here. It's always our first suggestion when someone calls us and says, hey, I want to get a good picture of the area. We can tell them that, we can share our resources, but if they join our Discord, it gives them an opportunity to hear from community members directly about their experiences and things that we may not know yet. So it's a great space. If we can move, yes, advocacy, great. So advocacy. It's a key part of what we do. And I think a lot of people conflate advocacy with lobbying sometimes. We're a 501c3. We don't do that. But we do advocate and we do educate. Education is key to our work and key to our advocacy. So we'll have individualized advocacy where someone may come to us and say, hey, I'm experiencing this problem with a healthcare provider. My kid's experiencing discrimination at school. Things like that. Or, hey, I need emergency housing. How can we get that? I need legal help. We can provide them, you know, situation-specific information to support what they need, and also educate them on what the rules and policies are out there. Again, Illinois is an incredibly affirming state. Champaign-Urbana is an incredibly affirming community, but that does not mean that everyone in the community is up to date on what the laws and regulations are. We can do that for people and educate, and we do it quite a bit. And then we do policy and civic advocacy through educating our legislators. You know, we want to have a good relationship with the people who are making policies so that they understand why it is so vital to make inclusive policies. Queer people cut across every intersection of identity, and everything that a legislator does is going to affect a queer person at some point. So whether that's engaging with legislators and policymakers and leaders in the community who we know are on our side, or engaging with those who are maybe not so affirming, we make every effort to work with them, educate them, and ensure that they understand that everything that they do is going to affect a queer person's life. Through our advocacy, we are a proud partner of Equality Illinois, which is the largest and oldest advocacy organization for LGBTQ community members in Illinois. But we also work with Centerlink, the CoLab, the National LGBTQ Plus Task Force, Planned Parenthood, Illinois Action, and the Human Rights Campaign to support all of these efforts and ensure that we are educated so that we can go and share that information with the community. So the next slide, community events. These are probably what people know us best for. Love Fest is our Valentine's Day event, which started, in 2022. So we're coming up on 4+ years of it soon, which is crazy. But it's a really, really cool opportunity. Again, we have incredibly affirming businesses. We have incredibly affirming partners across the community. But there are a lot of queer people who still do not feel safe going to a restaurant on Valentine's Day, walking down the street holding their partner's hand, things like that. So we created Love Fest as an experience for queer adults who want to share their love, whether it's with a partner, whether they're bringing their friends, having a good time, and get to have a traditional Valentine's Day experience, you know, a dinner and a show, something special where they know that they're safe and able to engage as authentically as possible. This last year, we added a new portion to Love Fest where we provided free childcare. We're excited to continue that because there are a lot of queer parents who don't necessarily get to come to the drag extravaganza or all of the pride events and things because they have kids to take care of. So we want to take that off their plate and give them one night where we've got it covered. We've got the kids in a safe space. They get to have a fun time, crafts, things like that. And their parents can go and have a good time and celebrate Valentine's Day. Adult queer prom and adult homecoming are programs similar to teen queer prom. Again, so many adults did not get to have the opportunity to have a school dance where they got to be 100% authentically themselves. So we want to provide that space. We're hoping to provide it again during Pride Fest in just a couple weeks and give them a space where they can come and have a dance and have a good time. June, of course, we're doing a ton of Pride programs here in the community while Pride Fest happens in the fall so that we can support our student friends. You know, we do want to make sure that Pride Month is a good time for everyone of all ages. We've got a ton of programs and events every year. I think this past June, we had over 30 different hits, whether it was our partnership or our events or partner events. So it just gets bigger and bigger every year and gives people, you know, a reason to celebrate and enjoy Pride. So Pride Fest, again, this is probably what we are best known for. We are the largest Pride Festival in the state of Illinois outside of Chicago. Don't let Springfield tell you any different. But we are the largest, and we're going to continue to grow. Last year, we estimated that over 30,000 attended across 9 days of programs. So come see us October 25th. We're going to be right outside. Come have a good time with us. But we have 10 days of programs this year, kicking off on October 16th. Everything from education to fun programs like the fair, the parade, the drag extravaganza. We have a youth and family party. There's lots of really cool opportunities this year, and we're excited to see it grow. Again, if you were here 15 years ago, it was in Lincoln Square Mall. I remember working that first Pride for Planned Parenthood, and it's crazy to see how massive we have gotten. So then our kind of last categories really are around needs-based services. We have a food pantry that also has harm reduction supplies, so things like Narcan, fentanyl testing strips, pregnancy tests, Plan B. In addition to food and toiletries, we just started a partnership with the Right Soapery, which is a local soapery, and we're able to provide free handmade soap to our clients now, which is really, really cool. In the last year, we saw the food pantry visited over 320 times. We gave around 2,000 pounds of food away, and it continues to grow bigger year after year. Up and Away is our binder and waste center program. So folks who may be experiencing gender dysphoria, folks who may be transitioning and they need garments that make them feel affirmed in their identity, we can provide those things absolutely free of charge to anyone in the community, up to 2 binders and 2 waste centers a year. Last year, we saw 56 service users, and we gave away around 100 binders and waist cinchers. But that program, we've sent it all around the state. We have seen, in the last year, requests from over 20 counties. We've seen requests in the past 3 years since that program started from over 20 states and 3 countries. This is a huge need in our community. Binders and waist cinchers are massively expensive and really hard to get, especially if you're a young person in maybe a household that's not affirming. We can ship them anywhere in the state. We do that a lot here in the community for people who can't come to our office. For those who can come to our office, we do professional fittings. Aiden's our expert on fittings, and we can give them an experience that helps them, you know, get safely into garments and understand the risks around wearing those garments and how to do it safely and securely. We just started a new program in February where we have a queer clothing closet. We've had more than 25 service users come and use it since then. It's been a real hit. One client recently just came from a residential treatment program and said, so many people come into this program and don't have clothes. Can I pick up clothes and take them to them? So now we're starting to funnel clothes into those programs and help people who really don't have even the clothes on their back. The Queer Library is also a relatively new program. I don't have to tell you that there are books being banned left and right. Thankfully, Illinois is generally on the best side of that and not allowing that to happen. But we wanted to be proactive and wanted to make sure that if people wanted to read about queer history or queer identity, no matter what age, that they have those things available to them. We have well over 100 books now, so please come check them out, come read them. We get so excited, especially when families bring their kids in and the kids go ham on the library. It's really, really cool. Again, you know, being a young queer kid 15 years ago, trying to find queer books as I was coming out was really difficult. Now we have a lot of them that are age appropriate for quite literally any age, and lots of great stories to tell. So this last category, education, awareness, and community resources. Again, for us, everything comes back to education. No matter what service people are engaging with, we try to make sure that they have all the tools in their toolkit to understand queer identity, to understand their rights, to understand the policies that support them in the community. And we do that through educational workshops. So many of our partners who are in this area, whether they're businesses, whether they're nonprofit organizations like us, whether they're healthcare providers, schools, have taken our cultural competency lessons where we talk about everything from breaking down identity, talking about intersectionality, talking about pronouns. That's always the number one is like, can you come teach us about pronouns? And we're happy to do that. We have grown those workshops into a really robust program that handles cultural competency. We have a homelessness workshop. We just did a workshop with the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault on homelessness and the intersection of sexual violence in the queer community. And we're happy to tailor those programs to people who, you know, need a specific program or a specific topic covered. So it can look different in every environment, but we're happy to do this education because it's so important. Then our affirming directories, we have three affirming directories, including our faith community. So lots of incredible faith communities here in Champaign-Urbana that are supportive of queer folks who want a faith space. They can find that there. We have a healthcare directory, whether that's mental health providers, whether that's physical health providers. You know, you can go and get on there, share what services you provide, what insurances you take. We're always updating it. So please, if you know a provider who is safe and affirming, have them reach out to us so we can get them on there, because that is a huge request, especially right now with gender affirming care under attack. And then finally, we have our affirming directory for businesses. Again, if you know a business owner in the area who is queer affirming and supportive, have them reach out to us, because we get so many people who are like, I want to spend my dollars consciously and intentionally. Where can I go? And we have some incredible partners. Pride is a great place to see them, but we want to make sure that year-round people understand who's supportive in this community. And then we have just wider resources on the website that we're always updating, always looking to add new things to, whether it's around coming out, whether it's around, you know, again, policy, whether it's parent resources, things like that. We're always looking to update it. So definitely check those out. But yeah, that's kind of the general overview. Do you all have questions or anything for me?
I have a question.
Yeah.
So fabulous job. So talking about the Eat Up program, I love that you guys not only offer food, but also personal care items. And then I like the harm reduction supplies and what all that encompasses. So where do you get your donations from? Like, does Eastern Illinois Food Bank help you guys at all? Or how do you guys usually get your items?
So yeah, we are a partner with Eastern Illinois Food Bank. We're able to purchase food through them. That's our primary resource. But we do get a lot of community organizations that want to do food drives. We do gladly welcome that. We do try to caution people, though, when they do food drives, that just make sure you're checking your expiration dates and stuff so that we don't have to do it on the back end. But the bulk of it does come from the Eastern Rhode Island Food Bank. Harm reduction supplies, they come through partnerships with public health, with the Urbana Champaign Reproductive Justice Project, with Planned Parenthood. We just got Sharps containers as well. So yeah.
I always, and you've probably heard me say, because you've been to a few of our meetings, sometimes when there's special events in the community, I like to use Divine Consign, where you can buy women's clothes. Usually they have bins set up and you can bring in personal feminine hygiene products in exchange for having to wait to the next day to shop if you bring in. So maybe, you know, as events come up in the community, maybe something will fit hand in hand if you're not already doing that. And like you said, you have businesses, maybe they'll, you know, $10 or 10% off today if you bring in, you know, some personal hygiene or something. But again, good job. And thank you for all you do in the community.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And yeah, we absolutely take every opportunity to do that. I know New Era is about to do a drive for us that's similar around that. So we definitely are always looking for partnerships in that way as well. Yes.
I thank you so much for your presentation. I was just curious about, you have an elder support group, and I wonder if their stories are being captured in any way, or if they would be interested in that, you know, like writing or oral history or something.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That is something that we want to do going into this living history, is understanding how to capture those stories best. And I know there's been some recent archival work with like the University of Illinois Library that captured some of the stories around like the queer bars and things like that throughout the history here in the community. But it is definitely something that we are looking to do as we head into this program this year.
No question. Just a comment. I want to say you're doing a great job, and you are doing a lot. And I really like that you mentioned a couple times about working in other counties, because Champaign is a little more open than other places. You said you went to Tolono.
Yeah.
I'm from Champaign, but I went to Gibson City. Yeah, and Paxton, yes. So yeah, I really like the focus. I mean, you got to keep it here, but also reaching out and branding, because I think there's a lot more stigma and marginalization going on in these smaller towns. Not saying it's delightful here all the time, but yeah, I just wanted to say I really like that.
Thank you. Yeah, no, and that's definitely something that we have conscious conversations about. Again, I'm from a rural community. I still live in a rural community. I live in Philo right now. And, you know, people are shocked and surprised to hear that in what appears as a very blue affirming county, there are still these pockets that are less affirming. One of the ways that we do that work is we try to engage as many school districts as possible, as many public libraries as possible, sometimes to better and more friendly results than others. But it is definitely something that, you know, we really want to grow and continue to do in this community. But I will say, we have some really incredible partners across this region that are not staffed or not incorporated yet, that are doing really, really amazing work, and we get to partner with them and kind of advance that. So thank you. Yeah.
Again, just excellent presentation. It's great to hear how much you guys do, and, you know, just trying to think of what else is there to be done. I just think about, you know, the only two things I can think of are, do you guys have a list of housing resources or landlords that are more friendly for people that may come in that, you know, have a housing difficulty at that time, and then people that are suffering like a mental health crisis, who you guide them to? And then I guess my third last question would be, do you guys work with the schools or meet in the schools in any way for some of our like maybe high school kids?
Yeah. So I guess I'll start at the schools. Yes, in Champaign-Urbana, both public school districts work with us quite a bit. We had a partnership with Edison School specifically, where we were able to do our educational cultural competency trainings for Edison over the course of 2 weeks each year, and we trained every student in the school. So over 800 students got to see those presentations. We're excited to continue that. But we go into several schools, whether we're training staff, whether we're training students. We already have several lined up for this fall, including Uni, Campus Middle School Girls Academy, Urbana School District, just to name a few. And we do try to offer those to, again, as many schools as possible. Every year we send out the, hey, we have this, we'll come do it for free. We will like do whatever it takes to like get in and talk to you, whether we're talking to your board, whether you're talking to staff, students, your GSAs, your drama clubs, whatever. We want to be there because we know that kids are left out. So yeah, definitely starting there. For housing resources, we do have some housing resources on the website. It is something that we want to continue to improve, especially around understanding which landlords are maybe more friendly than others. We do have a wonderful partnership with Cunningham Township, and we're part of the LGBTQ plus continuum task force. So Cunningham Township, GCAP, us, we get to do some like emergency housing services to give people temporary shelter for up to 14 days. That's a program that has been mostly funded by private donors. So we're able to do some like emergency housing work there. But it really is a question that we get asked quite a bit, especially in this day and age. People are really, really shocked when we talk about the fact that when people are wanting to move out of less affirming states or less affirming areas, people assume that they want to go to Chicago or they want to go to the suburbs. They can't afford those places. They can't easily get into to housing there or into school districts there in the same way that they can here. So they're coming to this area. We are taking several calls, several emails every week around, hey, I'm moving, we need emergency housing service. You know, we need help paying for a moving truck. We need these kind of services. So we do try to keep as up to date as we can on understanding which services are the safest to recommend people to. It is something that we desperately wish we could have a fund that we could say, here's $500 for a moving truck. You know, if any of you know a millionaire who wants to give us a little money, we would love that. And could you repeat the other question you had? I'm so sorry.
The last question was just, if someone's going through a mental health crisis, what do you do? What do you recommend?
Yeah. So if people are experiencing an emergency, of course, we recommend that they go to, you know, an emergency service. But if they're someone who's, you know, going through a downturn or, you know, the beginnings of a crisis, we do always refer back to our healthcare directory. I will say, we do get a lot of requests about the healthcare directory, and specifically not just around who's affirming, but what the alternatives are for insurance. That is the biggest hiccup for our community when they're seeking healthcare services. In our experience, there are so many community members who are on Medicaid right now. I was on Medicaid before this, and finding a mental health care provider who is affirming and also would take my insurance was next to impossible, even here. There are a lot of providers with sliding scale, which is really wonderful, but even some of those rates are inaccessible to our community. And scheduling is also difficult. So it's hard. We try to work with those providers as much as possible. We'll reach out if we have like a client concern and see if they can direct us to better resources. But a lot of times they do get directed towards like OSF.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate everything. Like, you guys are doing an amazing job at literally covering everything that you possibly can in the community. So, you know, thank you, and, you know, keep up what you're doing.
Thank you so much.
We'll need to move on to our next speaker, but I wanted to make sure that everybody knows, like, we will have an open portion at the end where all of our speakers can continue to share, and the board can continue to ask questions, and then anyone else who's in attendance can share questions or comments as well. But thank you so much for your presentation, and I will defer to Leon Bryson to introduce our next speaker.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I heard the term earlier said that there's a lot of work going on, and I want you to just sit still and listen to this next bio, okay? This person is an educator, advocate, creative, and community engineer. Justin Michael Hendricks is a native son of Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. He is the creator and founder of Hittin' Homeboy, a grassroots organization whose mission is to provide inclusive, equitable education and resources to marginalized communities. Hittin' Homeboy, established in 2019, addresses issues of food insecurity, mental health, gun violence, LGBTQ plus challenges, and poverty. As a community leader, Justin Michael Hendricks' effort in equitable access earned him the 2021 Buy Black Shambana Community Impact Award. He is an advisory group member of the legislation group Equality Illinois, the GLAAD Media Institute, and Ballroom Legendary House of Lanvin. Did I get that right? Lanvin. All right. Justin has been featured in GLAAD's I'm Voting No Matter What and St. Louis Efforts for AIDS campaign for his advocacy, civic engagement, and policy knowledge while living in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm not done. He earned his Bachelor's of Science in early childhood education with a special education endorsement from the College of Education at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign in May 2025. Recently, Justin Michael Hendricks became a two-term elected official as a member of City of Champaign Unit 4 School Board after an election victory on April 1st, 2025. In addition, he is launching Hittin' Homeboy with partnerships throughout the city of Champaign for Black and Brown LGBTQ plus teens and young adults later this year. Without further ado, Mr. Justin Michael Hendricks, please.
Thank you all for the invitation and being here, and also thank you all in solidarity for our community, for your services, for your work, and happy Pride as every day as we say. Personally, I wanted to express a focus that I'm always proud to be a part of, which is the Black community, also being a part of the queer and trans community as well, and I wanted to ensure that with my mission and my purpose for today that we are conveying a message to ensure that we provide services to Black communities, especially when it comes to LGBTQ rights and services. So I want to start with the mission statement, and it is an infographic type of look. So I'll be just doing some points, and then I'll ask you then go to the next info slide if possible. So first I'm going to start with our mission statement. Hittin' Homeboy's mission statement is to provide inclusive, equitable education and resources to marginalized communities. Hittin' Homeboy addresses food insecurity, mental health, gun violence, LGBTQIA plus challenges, and poverty. So for example, looking at the infographic, if you scroll down to number 3, we have addressing the issue. So we have been actively providing since the summer of 2019 and 2020, finding that food insecurity is a big issue in Champaign-Urbana, especially in Champaign's downtown area. With that being said, we came together in a sense of protest and demonstration to then provide food insecurity forms of combat in which we were creating a food pantry. And with that food pantry downtown, we were able to ensure that our downtown areas, our unhoused populations, can receive services and safe spaces to grab things that they need. One of the common quotes that we used was, Take what you need, leave what you can. And with that being said, we push advocacy, community culture, and education. Furthermore, we know that with the food pantry concept, we also were able to have a collaboration with the First Followers for a temporary pantry and also with Bethel AME Church, because we realize in certain populations in the Black community, there are food deserts that do exist, but there are also food deserts that we do not know about. Furthermore, in the Black community, sometimes when it comes to food insecurity, we may not know if we're experiencing food insecurity. Even though we're hungry, it may be deeper than what we're thinking. Next, I'll go then to number 4. So with understanding our metrics, we realize that with our population of food insecurity and individuals that are utilizing our pantry, 87% of people that utilize our pantries identified as LGBTQIA+. So we knew automatically, with that being said, there's a huge, huge concern with food insecurity, but furthermore, accessible resources to LGBTQ people. Furthermore, in the Black community, we understand that queer and trans folks, furthermore, are further along with disparities compared to our white counterparts, our non-Black counterparts in LGBTQ spaces as well. Number five. In the sense of monitoring our campaign, between 2020 and 2024, we have raised over $10,000 through grassroots initiatives, community food pantry organizing, and in-kind hours. We learned that a lot of times we take the mission of humanity over charity, because sometimes when you think of charity, you're trying to think of consciously, how much should I give? We believe in humanity because it comes from the heart. It's something genuinely that we believe in doing. So we're always promoting humanity over charity. You may go to the next infomercial for performance. And next, we'll then go to number seven. We understand that when it comes to LGBTQ people, they are having a higher experience of food insecurity in comparison to non-LGBTQ Americans. And this was taken from a census in 2021 for data collection that we then used to promote when we were gaining services for our food pantry. You may now go to the next one for commitments. The next infomercial for commitments, please. So for commitments, as we said, education, advocacy, and community culture. When it comes to education, we believe in providing educational stability. We educate on historical insurance and influence of Black and brown people in our spaces and history. When it comes to advocacy, we ensure that we have civic engagement. We also do policy understanding and advocate for those in marginalized communities as well. When it comes to community culture, we ensure we produce the city something that is a wraparound approach of all things Black, queer, and trans, whether it's in our missions of advocacy and education, when it comes to providing services such as our book drives, when it comes to our ballroom events, when it comes to voter registration. We are ensuring that Hidden Homeboy is a vehicle for the Black community, especially when it comes to queer and trans folks. When it comes to number nine, are some of our outcomes that we have had, because I'll just give you a gist of 6 through 8 after this. For number nine, what we have learned is that we were able to inspire the youth. So, for example, in our spotlights, we understand that when it comes to advocacy, we're able to help with HIV curriculum bill. I'm sorry, with the decriminalization of HIV bill, also with the inclusive bill, also the Keep Health and Safe in Schools Act, and also Protect Black Girls and Women Act, and other forms of policy that's protecting our communities. We've had two members of our programs come through and become success stories. We have Ayan Harris, who is a founding member of Pain to Peace. She is a Hampton University student and graduate now. She's also been a Spotify Next Gen Scholarship recipient. And then also we have Kobe Clark, who is a current mentee away at Michigan University currently right now. So in all, I'll just give my my spiel without looking on the screen anymore. We have three asks, basically. The first ask is equity. We understand that monetary support for Hidden Homeboy's efforts in education, advocacy, and community culture can support all things Black, queer, and trans. Two, we are requesting access. Resources available to allow Black LGBTQIA+ individuals for awareness and inclusivity. Three, opportunities that invite engagement to ensure Black LGBTQ folks can be involved for representation, programming, and services. We are seeking support as a grassroots organization to continue our food pantry, our Black, queer, and trans safe spaces when available in the Black community, and our Young, Gifted, Black, and Queer book drive that supplies literacy to Black and brown, queer, and trans families. Our goal is to ensure that we're providing literacy materials to raise awareness in academia, not an agenda. In addition, securing sponsorship and event spaces to produce ballroom curated programming to showcase Vogue culture and history through ballroom culture. We understand that Vogue is very popular, but people do not understand the beginning of Vogue and where it came from. It did not come from Madonna. It came from Black and brown, queer, and trans women seeking space. Last year, Hidden Homeboy hosted a ballroom event, but furthermore, before that, we hosted clinics to showcase various categories like Vogue and Runway with participants nationally known from the ballroom scene. Furthermore, after that, we then hosted a ballroom Vogue event called the Be Yourself Ball at the Illini Union with sponsorships from the City of Champaign, GCAP, and many others to ensure that we're able to have ballroom participation during Pride events. We are currently seeking locations and sponsorships for our Pride Fest that we're talking about because we want to ensure that Black Pride is also promoted because that's something that's lacking in Champaign County. We were planning for October to have our Black LGBTQ Fest, but unfortunately unable to, but we were acknowledging because it was Black History Month for Black and Brown, Queer, and Trans folks. However, with the difficulties due to cultural incompetence and the lack of inclusion for Black LGBTQIA people populations, we are now here locally expressing our concerns for having space for us to do more. Could you imagine a Black Pride at Douglas Park or in the North End in general? An Audre Lorde Lit Academy for writing poetry and more? Or even the Bayard Brigade for Black Queer Boys in honor of Bayard Rustin? I can. We strive to change the narrative culturally in the Black community. Hidden Homeboy prides itself on grassroots efforts and mutual aid for the belief in humanity over charity. Furthermore, we understand the impacts Hidden Homeboy can provide to a demographic constantly overlooked or unwanted for engagement. Hidden Homeboy strives for education, advocacy, and community culture. If you all would like to donate, you may utilize our Cash Apps or Venmo at Hidden Homeboy 88, which is HittenHomeboy88. Again, thank you all.
Thank you very much. So we can take some board questions now.
I know you're cutting for time, so I'll make it short. I have a question. I just want to say, you probably don't know who I am, but I know who you are. I've been watching you since 2020 with Drake and all them and the hair cut place downtown and the pantry. Yes. And you are an amazing leader, and a lot of us know who you are, and you keep doing what you're doing. I mean, everyone here is doing a great job, but I can't cuss. I admire you. We'll just put it down.
I accept it humbly. Thank you. But I just want to say it's not just one person. It's not just me. It's a community of people. For example, Megan McDonald, one of the people that have been with me since 2019, 2020. Also, Rita Connolly, Drake Mateer, is not just myself. It's a team. And the one thing I always believe in ensuring that I speak in we in these situations, not I. So I do thank you.
That's
but
why I admire you.
Ensure
awesome.
That it's extended to other people as well.
Well, I will admit this is the first time when I read my packet that I heard about you, and I am highly impressed what I see. I have already liked your Facebook page, and so I want to see if there's anything I can do to get involved and things like that. But good job.
Thank you very much. I look forward to communicating with you.
I just was curious if you didn't have any limitation with, like, funding or anything like that, what would be the next obstacle to creating, like, a Black Pride Fest?
So when it comes to a Black Pride Fest, it's something that I would like to mirror as in Chicago or St. Louis, where I have lived and participated in. We're ensuring that we're providing ballroom culture, history, a safe space, also ensuring that we have services and resources, but also the influx of culture when it comes to being Black, but also Black and queer, Black and trans. We also want to ensure we're having a safe space. So that's like entertainment. We're also providing resources from educational resources to health. So when it comes to Black Pride, it's no different than a Champaign-Urbana Day or a typical Pride Fest, but it's geared towards culturally to Black and Brown, queer, and trans folks.
Do you feel like you have people that you would be able to put together to make that happen if the funding was there?
If the funding was there, I believe that I can accept as many helping hands as possible. It's not just one person.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I have a question percolating, but it's not ready yet. Okay. But so if any other board members have questions or comments, please feel free.
I do want to make one thing clear, though. Also, when it comes to LGBTQ people, especially in the Black community, when it comes to healthcare, it does not discriminate within the community. For example, when it comes to HIV and AIDS, we understand that Black women are at the highest rate. So that's also a huge factor that we also extend outside of LGBTQ spaces. We want to ensure that we are providing a safe space to connect to others and also acknowledging them as well to know that when it comes to healthcare, resources needed, education, equity, and spaces, that we're including all Black people as well and not being discriminatory.
I think for my question, I guess I'm still formulating it, because I think like we'll have opportunity to discuss later on, but I also want to make sure we get to hear from you while you're here. What, I guess, in terms of like interconnectedness between resources, like what are ways that you think like that other mental health resources that may or may not be present in the room could could better center Black and Brown LGBTQIA plus folks and or collaborate with your organization?
One thing that's very important to me is civic engagement. When it comes to civic engagement, that means you're going out into spaces that are not your typical spaces. For example, I'm very big on acknowledging the North End, Bradley McKinley, Garden Hills, because those are areas where Black LGBTQ people do exist, but they are not able to have the resources in comparison to their white counterparts and their white counterparts' neighborhoods. So I want to ensure that when it comes to civic engagement, that is something that's very important to me, to ensuring that we're able to have the connectedness that's needed in the city, but also Champaign County, to know that when it comes to LGBTQ issues, that we do have Black representation at the table, involved in programming and other things that happens around the city and county at large.
It's definitely understandable. And I'm also thinking about ways that, like, you know, our affirming directories could, you know, ensure that they are also affirming to Black and Brown folks, and as well as disability and affirming. So that's kind of something I'm thinking about in terms of like making sure that our inclusive resources are inclusive, like in a variety of different dimensions.
Yes, I totally understand. For example, when it comes to our Black and our Young Gifted Black and Queer Book Drive, when we're supplying literacy materials to some families, some of our families are a part of the special education disability community culture. And so we will also ensure that when it comes to some of our books, we are making sure they're inclusive and geared towards those families specifically. So we also want to ensure that when it comes to our programming, though right now is a small time frame to extend of conversation, but I'm always open to have the conversations at the table to be more in depth with Hidden Homeboy and what we can do and provide for services.
Any other questions or comments from the board? We may have a question online.
I'm blind without my glasses. I didn't look like somebody was asking something.
There are comments. Oh. I can read the comments too. All right.
Thank you, Sandra.
We have a few comments online. It's Rita says, "Let's go, Hidden Homeboy, JMH." So proud of all the work Justin is doing in the community with our Black and Brown LGBTQ people. And it's important to be comfortable being uncomfortable. Great presentation and great responses.
Thank you all.
Thank you so much. With that, I will defer to Leon to introduce our next speaker.
We have another heavy hitter. Sit tight. Daria Shigebe is a passionate advocate for health equity, housing equality, social change, and LGBTQ rights. As a skilled nonprofit leader, her work is rooted in harm reduction and the belief that housing and health care are basic human rights. In her role as executive director of the Greater Community AIDS Project, she oversees housing and supportive services for individuals living with or affected by HIV/AIDS. Daria brings broad experience from her prior roles, which includes HIV case manager, counselor, programming director, research coordinator, and family advocate. Please extend a warm welcome to Daria.
Oh, it's okay. I'm going to sit down. Do you want it?
I'll take it. If it's not working.
That's okay. Thank you for the introduction. Yeah, I'm Daria. I work at the Greater Community AIDS Project, and I'm here with Meg, who was mentioned. And I first, before I get started, I want to mention the work that Justin does with us. This year, he was a speaker for National Black HIV and AIDS Awareness Day. So I just want to thank him for doing that and the continued partnership we have with him. So a little bit about GCAP. We were founded 40 years ago. This is actually our 40th anniversary. We've been here serving folks in the community since the beginning of the AIDS crisis. Initially, our name was the Gay Community AIDS Project, but this changed over time. Just given the large community that we serve, we no longer just serve LGBTQ or gay folks. We serve people of all races, ethnicities, ages, everything, because HIV and AIDS do not discriminate. And we've actually started serving not only folks who are living with HIV and AIDS, but are at risk, because this is a huge population, and it is also prevention. And to reflect this, we updated our mission statement. It was 40 years overdue. to specifically include individuals at risk and also families. This is our mission statement. I'd like to read it. Oh, you're putting up the slides. Thank you. Yeah. So our mission statement is GCAP empowers individuals and families living with and affected by HIV and AIDS in East Central Illinois by providing housing and supportive services and actively works within the community to reduce virus transmission. Recently, we've seen a huge spike in requests from families, and also given the increase of folks living or moving to Illinois because of HIV discrimination laws or because of LGBTQ discrimination, we needed to include this. So I'm very happy that our mission has been updated to reflect what we do. And these are some challenges that are faced by the LGBTQ folks that we serve, either living with or at risk of HIV. And because we are a small organization and we work pretty closely with our clients, we get to hear a lot of concerns. So this first one is housing. As a housing provider, obviously we see that housing is a struggle. I think Josh mentioned earlier that folks have a hard time finding safe and welcoming housing. Sometimes there are places in town that offer roommate matching. They can work to find a pair so that it can cut down on rent costs. But this can be unsafe. We've had folks who have reported, I just can't do that. This is not someone I can live with because of homophobia. And there's just not enough affordable housing options in general. This isn't specific to identity, but this is something that has been incredibly challenging for us. The fair market rent for a one-bedroom is $900, and every single one-bedroom around here is about $1,000. So trying to get folks into permanent housing is impossible, but we do it. Well, Meg doesn't. Also with housing, we have seen a huge increase of people relocating to the area. We serve all of East Central Illinois, and that includes Effingham. So folks actually are moving from Effingham, not only just Indiana, Ohio, the red states around us. It's actually also just in Illinois, too. And shelters, we have heard this multiple times. Shelters, the shelter here, I'm not going to say shelters because we have one. Let's remind ourselves that. The shelter here can be unsafe. We've had folks who will willingly sleep on the streets because they do not feel safe in the shelter. Or folks who have had their status revealed in the shelter and don't feel safe because now people know and they don't want to be near them and they are going to physically hurt them. It's really sad. We now offer increased emergency housing. This was typically something that we were only able to do when we had donations, but it is now something that is funded, and I will speak about that later. And for financial struggles, this is just something that we see statistically. Folks who are gender and sexuality minorities get paid less. They typically, if you look at the dollar for heterosexual and gender and sexual minorities, there is a difference. So What we do, we help them with financial assistance, and we try to lessen that burden. I'm going to go to the next one. I think I had a client quote. It got out of order. I don't know how that happened. Got all discombobulated. Well, I'll read it. Yeah, so this is a long quote, and I had to edit it, and I'm not going to read expletive. I'm just going to read the edited version. But this is a quote that I think is important. I came here because where I was before wasn't safe. It wasn't safe. Like, I was afraid I was actually going to get hurt. People in Southern Illinois are very terrible, and my family is part of those people, by the way. I got diagnosed not too long ago, and when I did, I thought, great, not only am I a gay, I am a gay with AIDS. These people are going to kill me. When my cousin found my meds, he told my brother, and I got kicked out. He had some stuff about the Bible. He said some stuff about the Bible and about me being dirty or whatever, and then said I had to leave, or he would call his friends, and they would make me leave. I left and came here because I heard it was less terrible. I didn't have anywhere to go, but you guys got me a motel room. That was literally a lifesaver, not to be dramatic, but it's true. I feel better here and have found my new family. Things are still kind of bad. Like, the people at my job aren't the coolest, but that's trade services, I guess. It's better than living in that hellhole. Thanks, guys. So we were really appreciative to get that comment. It was very honest, and he really shared from his heart. And we are really happy to have folks come here and feel safe. That is our goal. And our response to that, okay, thank you, is to provide transitional housing. First and foremost, we are funded to provide transitional housing. It is the bulk of our income, and it is what we've done for many years. The activists that I talked about earlier that founded GCAP also built our house, which has been around since 1990. It's older than I am. And so in this transitional house, we provide affirming and safe environment. A lot of our clients are LGBTQ, and we give them a space where they can be themselves without fear of discrimination. And I mentioned emergency housing earlier. This is something that we are new to providing, as in now it is fully funded. We have a process for folks applying for this, and we also provide case management and additional supportive services while they are in this. We have provided an absurd amount of emergency housing. And when I say that, I mean I would never expect that there would be this many calls from folks who say, I am literally homeless and I need some help. We provide up to 2 weeks, and this is funded by United Way and also by charitable trust grant through the Illinois State Attorney Office. And we also, as Josh said earlier, we work with the LGBTQ subcommittee and collaborate with other local folks to increase housing options and to just try to increase housing, try to reduce housing discrimination in our county. And as I mentioned earlier, we are funded by United Way and the Charitable Trust Grant, not only to provide emergency housing, but to provide financial assistance. And this is a lot of what we do. Folks contact us needing various things, help with rent, help with utilities, transportation, food, clothing, strollers, anything like that. These ease the financial burdens, and they help prevent homelessness. I've had folks ask me, why are you buying someone a couch? Because if they don't have a couch, or they use their money for a couch, how are they going to pay their utilities? Where do you want them to sit? So these essential household items are something that we will pay for, and questions like that always make me mad. The next one, that's the first page. What did you guys do to these? Sorry, I have what you all printed out. I'm trying to. Okay, I started at the end. It's actually healthcare and accessibility is first. It's this one, yeah. Thank you. So yes, inequities in healthcare. This is something that we get talked about, where we speak to folks about a lot. First, just how do I get connected to infectious disease? And it's harder than you would think. You have to get a referral from public health or from your primary care doctor. And given that there are 4 infectious disease doctors, you can get put on a wait list for a while. And then you have to cross your fingers and hope that you get put with the infectious disease doctor that is not transphobic. And if you do, that sucks, because that person has to allow you to switch providers. And this is very hard. And this is something that we have tried to remediate. And typically what we are told is there's an infectious disease program in Chicago. There's one in Peoria. Maybe they can try looking for a different provider, which is great. You know, you can really do that when you're homeless. So that's a huge inaccessibility for our clients. Also, there's incredibly long wait lists for affirming primary care physicians. When we go down this list of affirming providers and I give this list to clients, they say, I called them, I called them, I called them, I called them, and none of them are taking new clients. So we have to settle. And again, cross our fingers and hope that they're not homophobic or transphobic. Lack of insurance covered transportation to specialty care. So the folks that do want to go to Chicago, Peoria, all of those places, how are they going to get there? A lot of insurance, private insurance, covers up to 50 miles, sometimes 100 if you're lucky. But you have to make sure that you're there on time, sometimes 15 minutes before, or they will leave you. Most places, or most transportation that does most insurance that does cover transportation also gives you a 3-strike rule. So you don't cancel on time, you get there too late 3 times, and that sucks. You can't go to your doctor's appointments anymore. So these are the things that we try to at least help a little bit, because we can't fix the system. It's just 2 of us. And this next one is something that I talk about with every healthcare provider that I get in contact with, is do you know what PrEP is? Because some doctors don't. And if they do, why aren't they talking about it with their patients? There's a PrEP to need ratio that does not match the actual need. If we're looking at who is walking into their doctor's office, 94% of at-risk white Americans receive PrEP, compared to only 24% of Latin and 13% of Black communities. And this happens here too. When I asked my doctor for PrEP, she said, why? Do you know what that is? Why? And this shouldn't be something that is asked when we ask for PrEP, and this should be something that is asked when we're going through a routine screening. How many partners do you have? What kind of protection do you use? Are you interested in PrEP? So I am sorry to the providers that I have given many pamphlets to about PrEP, but I think it's important. We're also seeing a huge increase in diagnoses amongst Justin said, the young 18 to 35 African-American Black women. And we're trying to do outreach. We're working with public health to do outreach and education in that demographic. And I do have a client testimonial that I would like to read. Thank you. I'm on Medicaid and have been trying for months to find a therapist, preferably a gay therapist, or at least a therapist that is okay with me getting AIDS. Sorry, being gay. I want to be able to comfortably say, I'm gay, I have AIDS, and I'm depressed as hell. I went on to Psychology Today and type in champagne, then click LGBTQ. In person, Medicaid. I call one person and they don't accept Medicaid. I call another, they don't either. I call another and they do accept Medicaid, but there's a wait list and I'm 20th on the list. I finally find someone who accepts Medicaid and is taking new clients, and then I get an email asking me to agree to participate in telehealth services because apparently she doesn't do in-person sessions. I'm ready to rip my hair out. Why is it so hard to get help? And comments like these are what prompted me to apply for every single grant that comes my way in my email inbox, specifically the Charitable Trust Grant, because this grant, $20,000, is specifically to help folks who are at risk of HIV, and this can be used for mental health services. transportation to different places. Oh, sorry, can you go to the our response slide? Yes. So yeah, we'll provide funding for mental health appointments. We'll also work to find them a mental health provider that is affirming. We are currently capping that at 8 weeks, but if they use those 8 weeks and they continue to need assistance, they can also apply for our financial assistance program. We want to make sure folks are getting what they need. Transportation support, so we will buy folks train tickets, we'll get them an Uber or Lyft, we'll also drive them because sometimes they're more comfortable with that. We've had folks say, I just don't want to be in the car with that Uber driver. Last time this happened, specifically around Pride Fest, seems like when people get discriminated against in the Uber, I don't know why everybody comes out during Pride Fest saying, I'm just going to do this to harass people, but it's what happens. And seeing that is why we decided to start helping folks with transportation, not just for health or social service related appointments, but just for being able to travel places safely. Also, we offer health assistance. We'll actually go and we'll pay for their prescriptions and take it to them because we want to make sure people are getting their medication, whether it be antiretrovirals or PrEP. It's important. We will do what we can to help folks with that. And I talked a little bit about this, about the advocacy. I'm not always annoying about the advocacy. Sometimes I do advocacy by just talking to folks about what they can do for prevention, how they can keep themselves and others safe and healthy, and other things like that. And then the next one. Can you go to the next slide? Yes. Sorry, things got all discombobulated. So social stigma and stigma in general within the HIV and AIDS population is huge, and it is a huge barrier to care. And this was something actually that somebody spoke up about recently at a Getting to Zero tour, where they come around and try to talk about and ask folks from the community what they think their priority should be. But it wasn't just spoken about once, it was spoken about multiple times. Folks living with HIV and AIDS are saying, we are still being discriminated and stigmatized and dealing with this stigma here. Which is why we really, really try to teach folks that U equals U. How many people here know what U equals U means? Nobody knows what U equals U means. Undetectable equals untransmittable. Which means if you have an undetectable viral load, you cannot transmit the virus to others. So folks take antiretrovirals. I'm going to educate you all for a second. Folks take their antiviral medication. If they take it consistently, they will reduce the viral load in their body to below 20. They can. We want to see that below 20 number because it virtually means that they're undetectable. And when they're undetectable, they cannot transmit the virus to others. And a lot of folks don't know this. They think that if you have HIV or AIDS, you're going to give it to the next person that you see, and that maybe you'll give it to them by kissing them, which is not true. Maybe you'll give it to them by hugging them or sneezing on them or whatever, which is also not true. We teach folks how HIV actually spreads, how you can prevent it, and also how folks maybe just can't give it to you because they're taking their medication appropriately. Thank you all for learning about U equals U. And there's also still a lot of misinformation within the LGBTQ community, again, related to U equals U. Also, there's still this stigma and this question that gets asked, are you clean or dirty? Which I feel so bad for the folks that have told me that. It has been a huge problem with them, not only specifically on Grindr and places like that. Like, this is a question, a litmus test. Are you clean or dirty? And so seeing that stigma within the community is heartbreaking, and I hope that advocacy and education helps. I'm not going to say prevent that because that's not going to happen, but at least decrease it. And now gaps in social support. This is also an area that we see a lot of need. Folks don't know where to go. How do I make friends as an adult? this is something that our case manager works with folks to do every week, every day, really. People need help building support, and they also need help building support safely. The Public Health Department does run a support group for folks living with HIV and AIDS. It's not well promoted. I wish that more people know about it. There's also no third space. That's a comment that I've gotten. And folks have told me that they don't feel comfortable in young spaces and feel that groups are too formal. And this is where I'll go into the client testimonial. Yes, thank you. Oh, sorry, no. It says client testimonial dash social support. Yeah, thank you. I think if I had to say one thing that we really need here, it would just be a space to go to. The groups here are mostly for young people, and if they're not for young people, then they're online. I want to actually go somewhere. I need to leave my house and be around people. But where does a dyke in her mid-40s go? I could go to the bar, but I don't want to drink. That's bad news. But apparently that's where all the dykes go. It's disappointing. It really is. It makes me sad if I think about it for too long. I just want somewhere I can go and be around other queers, and I don't want to have to introduce myself when I'm there. Like I said, I just want a space to go to. And this is a client of ours that did give her initials and her age, TH, and she is 43 years old. This is actually something that I agree with. I would love to go somewhere and just be a fly on the wall without saying, hi, my name is Daria Shigavi, my pronouns are she, her, because I don't like doing that and I'm socially awkward. So I really agreed with this client. I think this is something that we really need here. We don't have any like gay coffee shops, coffee bars, anything like that, anything that's not centered around alcohol or the internet. I also would love to see this, and to see clients talking about this makes me want to do something about it, and I don't know how to right now, but I can direct her to places, direct her to folks in the community, and try to do the best that we can, and I'm glad that we're here trying to come up with solutions. The next page. I don't know. It's our response for, I don't know how this happened, for social support. Oh, yeah. There we go, yeah. So like I said, one of our responses is to provide case management. Before fiscal year 25, we did not have a case manager because we were not funded by CCMHB. This is actually our first year being funded by CCMHB, which, thank you all. I'm also very surprised given that we have been around for 40 years. But I am very grateful for this because now we have a case manager. And she works very hard to provide resources and opportunities for folks to go and build their social networks. And sometimes this looks like taking everybody bowling because maybe they want to join a bowling league. And we have had some folks get really into bowling. And they go bowling with each other, and it is very fun. Sometimes it's giving folks handouts, and also just talking with them about how to build confidence. Because if you build confidence, when you build confidence, you're more likely to reach out to others and build support networks. Like I said, we also do education advocacy. We also provide support during partner notification. This can be really scary for people to sit down and tell their partner, I'm living with HIV, especially if you've already been intimate, because folks, like I said, are ignorant to what U equals U is. And also some folks still think that it is a felony. In the state of Illinois, HIV is decriminalized. In other states, it is not. And you can get a felony for not telling folks your status. So people are really scared because they still think that, one, that that's the law still, and two, that that is something that their partner may think or that their partner might get angry. Because we have had folks who said, my partner did not react well and they became violent, and this is why I need housing support. So we provide that support. We want to be there, if anything, just as a mediator. And this is something I said earlier, and I just want to reemphasize this. The social support and community building is an ongoing concern, and it needs to be addressed. We get input from our clients to understand their needs and to collaborate with partners to find and implement these solutions, or to find and implement solutions to fill these gaps in care. We can't do it all, and we're not doing it all right now. And I am again, happy to be here working towards a solution. I think, sorry, all of these. there's one final page before the last page. There we go. This is the one before that. Yeah, this is just a little way to say how we are trying to fill the gap and meet the need. We talk about proactive advocacy and trying to work with folks to identify and just tell them about the laws. We recently went to HIV Advocacy Day at Springfield. Again, not lobbying, just advocacy. To advocate for policies that will directly affect our clients and to educate folks. One of the things that I thought was very important, and I want to share about this, when I was talking to a legislator in Chicago about funding, and I was sitting with other folks, they said, why do we need to fund this? Why HIV? Why AIDS? We're so oversaturated here in Chicago with homeless shelters. Why does this matter? And I spoke up and I said, this funding does not only support Chicago. This supports all of Illinois. And it's decisions like that that hurt our clients, that make it so that we can't support their fund, that we can't support them because we have inadequate funding. So like you said earlier, this is $6 million that you're able to distribute to people. And so our county funds that we're able to work with, I'm always grateful for, because while our federal and state funding and budgets are messy, our county funds seem to be more stable. I'm appreciative for that. And now I'm done.
Thank you so much. We will open it up to board questions and comments.
I have a question. Thank you for your presentation. Are there legal solutions to the discrimination that is being experienced that can be pursued, still be pursued, or is the problem more the enforcement of existing laws, do you think?
Both there are legal protections. There's the AIDS Confidentiality Act that we see violated, which we have tried to get folks help for, but I think that we direct them to the AIDS Foundation, AIDS Foundation Chicago. There's a specific legal network in Chicago that we direct folks to because they work with this. They work with violations of the AIDS Confidentiality Act. We once had someone post on Facebook publicly that so-and-so has AIDS, like in some expletives, which is illegal. You can't do that. You can get a felony for that. It's reckless, negligent disclosure of someone's status. And we can tell someone. We can tell local law enforcement. We can do all of that. We have done. We have encouraged folks, and nothing happens. It is something that we're going to have to change socially, and we can't do it using the legal system, unfortunately. And I think part of that is also stigma within the system.
So I just have a few questions. Do you know if anyone's reported the infectious disease doctor that is transphobic? Because you're supposed to be non-judgmental as a healthcare provider.
Yeah, more than once.
And so the hospital hasn't done anything to remedy that situation. Obviously, it continues to happen, so obviously it hasn't been remedied then, correct?
I cannot speak on Carl.
And then I guess one of my other questions is what, as like healthcare providers, could healthcare providers do to help in decreasing HIV rates in Black women in this area?
Yeah, so like I said, I think that every PCP, general practitioner, family doctor should talk about PrEP. When you do your intake and you're talking about sexual partners, sexual orientation, if they discuss more than one partner, if they display any of, or they discuss any of the at-risk categories, they should get a pamphlet at least about PrEP. They should ask the question, would you be interested in this preventative medication? Or shot that you only have to take a few times. we've seen because of the huge increase in diagnoses. I think this is so important. Also, we've had a big increase in diagnoses amongst youth. So seeing folks under the age of 18 either coming to the area or living in the area and getting diagnosed, I think pediatricians also need to have this conversation. Youth do have sex and they do participate or partake in at-risk behavior, so we have to make sure that we're also having those conversations with them, maybe when parents step outside, but I think that's very important.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I am going to start by saying my mom always taught me to no question is a dumb question unless you don't ask it. So thank you so much for explaining U equals U. I thought I knew, but I was so glad when you explained it because I was like, I'd actually started. Like, I need someone to explain that. And then as far as PrEP, can you give us just a quick understanding of that? I'm under the impression that, you know, I actually have a friend who is a gay man, and he talked about going on PrEP, and it was very cost prohibitive. So I don't know. Like, what kind of cost? Is that something where insurances don't want to cover it? I'll let you speak on that. And then probably my final thing is, a couple of you have seen me on this board for, I don't know, 5+ years. And my support to this community has grown so much. And part of that was because I've been educated. I grew up in a very rural Christian town that's bad. You know, man and woman, you know, da, da, da. And it took my daughters pretty much being like, Mom, wake up. They're still, you know, my friend that I am. We've had conversations in my own home about pronouns. I was able to do it a little bit better with our daughter than my husband. And then she kind of shortened her name, not legally, but instead of Reagan, she goes by Ray. And we respect that. So again, I always say I probably talk too much and I probably like fumble over myself, but I do feel like I have done some changing, and I think part of that's because I've been on this board and I've learned there's a lot of things that maybe the media doesn't always tell us. There's a lot of things we don't know. We think, oh, well, they're getting the help. No, they're not, you know, because they are this type of, you know, group. So thank you. If you'll, like I said, just a quick talk about the PrEP, and I'll be quiet.
Thank you. I'm also somebody who talks a lot and fumbles over my words. When I was talking about PrEP, I realized I didn't explain even what the abbreviation was for. It's a pre-exposure prophylaxis. So it's a prophylactic medication, so you take it to prevent something. And there are different kinds of PrEP depending on your body, depending. There's actually some that are recommended more for folks who are assigned female at birth. Also depends on your kidney functioning. So I'm not a doctor, but I will say that just simply, PrEP is a medication that prevents HIV and AIDS, and it is very effective if you take it regularly and as prescribed. There's also something called PEP, post-exposure prophylaxis, which is for folks who have had contact with somebody who is positive or have had like an accidental needle stick, something like that. For folks that go into the hospital after sexual assault, rape, something like that, they are also offered PEP because we never know the status of someone. So this is a medication also that we work with folks to get. And then your second question. Yes.
I guess to add on to that.
Oh, sorry. It was a very important question, and I think I should answer it. You talked about the financial burden of PrEP. So there's actually something called PrEP for All, and I think that this, again, has to do with education and how we need to educate the community. PrEP for All helps folks get access to PrEP, and PrEP is also a medication that should be covered by insurance, just like birth control. It is a medication that is preventative, and working with folks at the public health department, they have worked with almost, I think, everyone, Medicaid, private insurance. I think TRICARE is the only one that is challenging because it's government, military, I think. But you should not have any expenses related to PrEP, and if you do, we can help. People ask, what do you do? And a lot of times we say, what do you need us to do? And if that means covering costs for PrEP, we're going to cover costs for PrEP.
Which kind of leads me to a question that maybe even Dr. Joachim can answer. Is this something that can be given to, like, youth?
I am going to defer that to John.
So we can give it to youth. I prescribed it just only a handful of times just because it's not something that comes up as often. And then if it does happen or it does come up, sometimes we'll talk to some of our family medicine doctors who are usually more well-versed in that. We do talk to them about the importance of following the regimen because if you do get HIV if you're not taking it consistently or as prescribed, then it can become more resistant to treatment. So, you know, for the youth, you know, just making sure that they understand the importance of following the directions.
And would that be something you would have to have parental consent?
No. So sexual health, reproductive health, you can come in without a parent. So they don't need to know anything. It's something that anyone can come in for. So yeah, good question.
Over the age of 12? Yes, you can also go to the public health department alone, and because they offer free services to folks on Medicaid, folks 12 and up can ask questions about PrEP, get birth control, get HIV testing or any testing. So I think that's important for folks to know, 12 and up, your parents don't have to know.
Well, my kids are all above 18, but I've always been kind of like the cool mom that you can come to and she'll quietly help you with stuff. I've went with young individuals to Planned Parenthood and I'm like, I'll be there if you want to talk to your parents, but I just want you to be safe and smart. So another person, we had to do some STD testing and I'm like, mouth is sealed unless you want me to sit down with your parent.
And I think some parents or some patients, youth don't know that, you know, they think, okay, if the parent has access to my chart, are they going to see this? And you can actually hide notes. The doctor can, the provider can, so that the parent won't see that. I mean, they'll get the bill for the visit, but they won't know what you went for.
I kind of wanted to ask a related question related to PrEP, but I think just kind of overall, because I've definitely seen concerns about at the federal level that like both in terms of like what insurances are required to do and coverage and then like, but also research, what your concerns are about what may be coming and what may be changing and what things, what current resources might be at risk in the future.
Yeah, so for PrEP and for antiretrovirals and everything that has to do with HIV and AIDS, whether it be preventative or for folks living with HIV and AIDS, PrEP is, one, if you go to the CDC website and you try to look at PrEP, well, that website was taken down for a while because, gay people. And now if you go on there, the at-risk populations, they don't mention LGBTQ folks. It mentions folks who have partaken in high-risk sexual behavior, but they had to remove everything for DEI reasons. And so not having that there hinders folks' ability to know if they are at risk for something, hinders other folks in the community who are studying PrEP, who are wanting to learn about PrEP, to know how to help other people. So there's that one. That one's big. There are also pushes to get PrEP not be able to prescribe for children, for youth. This is also going hand in hand with gender-affirming medication, HRT, everything like that. We don't want this to be prescribed to our children, and PrEP is one of those things as well. It reminds me of the HPV vaccine. So we see that, and for HIV and AIDS, right now folks can get their medication covered through ADAP, the AIDS Drug Assistance Program. This program is a lifeline for folks who are undocumented. If you are undocumented and you cannot get insurance, Medicaid, anything like that, The AIDS Drug Assistance Program will pay for your medication, your $3,000 per month medication. And we are wanting to remove folks who are undocumented off of that. So it's very challenging. It's hard to work within these. I get all these updates every single day, at least three, from AIDS Foundation of Chicago, from a, oh my gosh, a supportive housing network that is specifically working with folks living with HIV and AIDS. There is so much that I don't even think I can mention a tenth of it.
Thank you. I know there is so much, and I'm really appreciative that you did mention it, and I know it's very depressing. Any other questions from the board? Of course, we'll have more opportunity to speak later, but any other questions right now? All right, well, thank you very, very much, and we hope to hear from you more throughout the evening.
Thank you for putting up with the thing.
Yes. Leanne, we'll have you present our last speaker.
I think we'll need another microphone for the next two trailblazers. Okay. Victory and success and beauty, I think those are the terms to describe the names of the next two presenters, I think, if I was doing research correctly. Jaya Colasetti has an MA and MBA, is an award-winning administrator, educator, and anti-violence advocate, who has presented nationally on the topics related to sexual violence and social justice. She serves as the executive director of RACES and is an active member of the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assaults, People of Color Committee. Her previous experience includes serving as a chair of, is it ICASA? ICASA Social Justice and Training Committee, holding an appointed position on the Illinois Governor's Task Force on Campus Sexual Misconduct Climate Surveys, and working as a practitioner reviewer for the Center for Victims of Crime. Our next presenter is Callie Hines. Callie is an open, non-binary, and autistic professional with ADHD, who has 5+ years of experience working in social services settings. Currently, they are the office manager at RACES, making them a first point of contact. I'm tired. It's a long night. First point of contact for clients and members of the community. In addition, she is a student studying for her MS in forensic psychology at Walden University. They have previously provided training at local and statewide levels on neurodiversity and sexual violence, and are passionate about advocacy for those who are neurodivergent and the LGBTQ+ community. Without further ado, Jaya and Callie.
Thank you all so much for having us tonight. We don't have a presentation, partially because we want to try to avoid being too repetitive from previous speakers, so we might kind of touch back on some of the points that have already come up. I and some of our other colleagues have had the opportunity to speak to this body in the past, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time going back over RACES services, but just to briefly remind folks that we are the sexual violence and stalking prevention and response service provider for not only Champaign County, but also for Ford, Douglas, and Piatt counties, and that all of our services are free and come with absolute confidentiality. We have absolute privilege under state law. And again, my name is Jaya. My pronouns are she, her, and hers, and I'll let Kelly introduce themselves, and then we'll just kind of talk about some of the gaps that we have identified in services that are available here in Champaign County. And this is based off of feedback from friends, family members, colleagues in our office and clients, but we will not be sharing any client testimonial or anything that would be confidential communication because of our confidentiality.
Thank you. My name is Callie Hines. My pronouns are she, they. I'm really excited to be here with you all today. Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to talk to you all and kind of inform you about some of the different challenges that the community faces.
So I think to piggyback off of some of what has already been shared, I want to stress the issue around housing. So we are not a housing service provider. There are occasions where we have had to step in and help folks get connected to other, frequently we're stepping in to help connect people to other resources, but occasionally we have had to help get safe housing for an individual night. Currently in our community, if someone is a survivor of sexual violence or stalking, or if they're a survivor of domestic violence and are not, they don't meet the definition of actively fleeing, we don't have a good option, period, right? So I think it is important that we talk about this, especially in a conversation related to gaps in services for LGBTQ plus folks, because our LGBTQ plus community members experience disproportionately high rates of both homelessness, housing discrimination, and sexual violence. And that can be prior to becoming unhoused. That can also be an issue if someone is currently unhoused. As we were preparing for this, I was looking back at some statistics. The National Sexual Assault Coalition had a study in which they found that 22% of transgender individuals living in homeless shelters were sexually assaulted by residents or staff. So as was previously mentioned, we have very limited resources for folks who are unhoused. Often it's congregate shelter. Often those spaces do not feel safe, especially for our LGBTQ plus community members. So as was previously mentioned, that may result in people being on the streets where they are again at higher risk of experiencing sexual violence. The likeliness for multiple experiences of sexual violence throughout this process are significant. Interactions with systems may result in further discrimination, ranging from using the wrong name and pronouns to actively being hostile or dismissive to folks when they're trying to seek support and services. Did you want to speak on the housing piece? It's fine if you don't.
So there definitely needs to also be some enforcement on discrimination against those in the LGBT community who are trying to seek housing. There are housing complexes, apartment complexes in the area that can, they may even ask, you know, people in the community to disclose if they are in a relationship with a person who is the same gender as them, and have kind of implied that they do not, like, they wouldn't provide housing for them. I definitely think that it kind of breeds a distrust in the LGBT community when they go to these apartment complexes and they're like, I don't know if this is safe for me.
I think the other thing that we wanted to make sure that people remember is we've already lost at least one member of our community who was homeless and an LGBTQ member of our community who should have had access to safe housing, right? So I think it's very easy to look at this as a, this is a problem somewhere else. This is a problem here. We are losing members of our community because we do not have enough housing resources. Obviously, we have people who are doing incredible work around that particular part of the need, but the need is still significant. There just really are not enough options for people. Also, where we can, we often see this related to our work related, relates to medical care. So things like simple things, you know, our advocates may be the folks who are advocating to make sure, again, proper names and pronouns are used when people are seeking care in the emergency department, that providers are thinking about what parts of kits are appropriate, not assuming that they know just by someone, the way someone is presenting to them or read, how their gender is, and sex is read by that individual on a surface level. Gendered language can be very exclusionary in the work of sexual and domestic violence. I'm seeing Molly nod. I know we both have this common experience of previously working on campus where the only confidential advisors are housed out of the Women's Resources Center. They serve folks of all genders, but a lot of people, there is often that barrier of, well, you know, when we say women, does that mean all women? Yes, it does. But that's not always necessarily obvious when people are in a moment of crisis and trying to figure out where do I go. And if folks do not identify as women, again, is this a space that is safe for me? Is this a place that I can go to access support? So those are some like very simple things that can make it so it's very difficult for people to even get through the door and access services in the first place. Also, some of the resources that we have are provided by organizations with a religious affiliation. And while some of those organizations can still be affirming and welcoming, some of them may not be. And also trying to do that calculus of, I know this organization has a religious affiliation, I don't know if this is a safe place for me to go. And because we do have limited options in terms of behavioral health, for example, in terms of, again, homeless services, some of those other crisis services, if there is that religious affiliation and people don't have the information to know whether or not that may feel safe, it may be just by de facto people are going to say, I'm not going to try to even try that resource. So also kind of thinking about that piece. I think elevating what has already been shared about the cost related to both physical and mental health services and, of course, for housing as well is really important. You know, we again, are fortunate to be able to be a free service provider. We don't ask for insurance information, but we can only help people if they're working on things related to sexual violence or stalking, right? So for our clients, when they're at a place where they're like, I'm doing okay in terms of this piece, having folks that we can then refer them to for support after they don't need us, right? Having a list of affirming providers, and, you know, we're very privileged to be on the list for Uniting Pride, and certainly, you know, can make reference to that list and have folks that we trust in the community as well. But again, there are limits if people don't have insurance, don't have adequate insurance, may be undocumented, where do they go when they leave us, right? Because we don't ask for that information. We, you know, it's kind of obvious from Kelly's bio, but also want to recognize kind of the overlap between needs for LGBTQ plus folks and our neurodiverse and neurodivergent community. So I don't know, Kelly, if you want to speak that.
To kind of add to the conversation around the neurodiverse community and the LGBTQ community, there is a distinct lack of education within our community on LGBTQ plus issues and identities, even with like within providers or healthcare related spaces, mental health spaces. There's also a sense of a lack of trust, we could say, with providers. There's not much of a rapport built with some providers that we've seen when we have clients in the emergency room. There could also be language that's like very gender specific or gender oriented that can be alienating. But in addition to that, there is sometimes language that's more like leading or like kind of, I don't want to say coercive because it's not quite the word, but it kind of pushes them in a certain direction or maybe pushes them to make a certain decision. And that's part of why we're there, is to make sure that they don't continue to push them in that direction or continue to even blame shift or like make our clients uncomfortable. But there is definitely also a lack of like trauma-informed care or trauma-informed care specifically geared towards the LGBTQ or neurodiverse communities. And kind of diving into mental health as well, there is a distinct gap with mental health providers, psychiatrists, therapists, who will refuse outright to treat certain neurodiverse groups. And if you look at the statistics with the LGBT community and neurodiversity, a large portion of the LGBT community either is autistic or neurodiverse in some form, or identifies or like self-identifies as autistic, whether it's diagnosed or self-diagnosed or self-identifying. And again, there are providers who in this area will outright say, I don't work with people who are autistic, or I don't work with people who have this neurodiversity or this neurodiversity. And when you look at the overlap with the LGBT community and neurodiversity, that can be really alienating as well.
So some of that, again, goes back to that training piece. Another piece that we wanted to bring to the board's attention, though, as a funding body, is to think about the implications of what is happening at the federal level. And I know I've had great questions about, like, you know, what do we think is going to happen in terms of survivor services? The new language that is being incorporated into existing funding opportunities is specifically trans-exclusionary. Right. And so there was a funding opportunity that another provider locally in our office looked at, and included in the out of scope definitions were, quote, inculcating or promoting gender ideology as defined in Executive Order 14168, defending women from gender ideology extremism and restoring biological truth to the federal government. End quote. If you have not looked at that executive order, when you're in a good place to do so, I encourage you to think about reading that. Because when we talk about the impact on our community, interpretations of what that means for funding recipients, I'm not an attorney. Some funders or some organizations at this point are taking that as we can't use that money to serve these clients. Other organizations are taking it as we can't serve these clients. Others are taking it as we can't accept this money, right? So that's a, you know, we're talking about hundreds of thousands just related to sexual violence and stalking and domestic violence that is not approachable. I think that also thinking about the impact, even if that calculus is being made, okay, it just means we have to use CCMHB money to make sure that we're serving populations that are excluded from this, making sure that we're also thinking about what does that messaging look like to our community members so it's clear that we are not accepting those out-of-scope restrictions in terms of who we serve and who we care for. Another out-of-scope section specifically relates to DEI, so more broadly in terms of serving. So that one is promoting or facilitating discriminatory programs or ideology, including illegal DEI and diversity, equity, and inclusion and accessibility programs that do not advance the policy of equal dignity and respect as described in another executive order. So, you know, we can see that there were already gaps in services for LGBTQ plus folks in our community. This board is often a lifeline to make sure that we are working to fill existing gaps. And I feel like I'm always the bearer of bad news in terms of the federal government, but I think it's likely to get worse, right? Because I think a lot of service providers are going to be in a position to say, we cannot accept these terms, or we cannot pursue that funding because it means that we'd have to say yes to helping these clients and no to helping these. So just another piece, right? I don't want to repeat what has already been shared by other providers, but just to kind of show how this does intersect specifically with our work around sexual violence and stalking, and to think about, like, what are the funding implications for the new out-of-scope restrictions for many federal grants. Kelly, did you have any closing? Good. Okay. So I think we'll leave it there, and then if there are questions that we can answer, we're happy to do so.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments from the board? Well, I can go. I am having an emotional reaction. I'm not going to lie, because when I, for those who don't know, my career has predominantly been working with gender-based violence. And when I first started my job at the university, one of the things I was tasked with was to take the highly gendered language in our prevention programs and find a solution and change it. And it took a lot and years to get everybody on board. But it worked, and it made a positive difference. I
my students and I took it to conferences across the country and talked about what we did. And it breaks my heart that, like, I knew that what the implications of that executive order would be, but I hadn't heard that this is now directly affecting funding mechanisms in this, like, very, it just is, as many people have said tonight, like, this backslide, this, like, we're going backwards of things that we had to work so hard to change. And I do recognize where, especially already knowing that, you know, our board has been asked for funds for things that the federal government has already cut, and now this may be happening even more, but recognizing the importance of our board having this, the position that we can be in to step in and help and not have those restrictions. But also recognizing how, like, very complex that is around, like, how the interpretation of that is happening. So I really appreciate you bringing that to us, and it's very upsetting. Any other questions or comments?
I think Kelly may have had a response.
Yes, please, please do.
Kind of piggybacking on some of the recent executive orders, I'm sure that you all have heard about the Big Beautiful Bill as well, and how that will be affecting people who are on Medicare or Medicaid and receiving gender-affirming care. So that's just another consideration, as there are a large number of people in the Champaign-Urbana community who rely on those for their own gender-affirming care who don't have access to it at this moment.
Also incredibly upsetting and terrifying. Thank you for bringing that up. Other questions or comments from board members? I know we will have more opportunity to talk throughout, but thank you so much both for sharing. So we will now move to we have some other materials that have been prepared, and then open it up more to kind of board and community comments. So our next item is we have responses to an anonymous survey that was done on pages 45 to 56 of the packet, and I believe Chandra Somerville will be presenting that to us.
Hello. Just letting you all know, when I went back in to look at the survey again, when you all received this in, let's say, a few days ago, there were 95 responses. There are now 104 responses. You should close it, but, you know, I kind of don't want to close it. I want to kind of keep it open, because after this presentation, we might get more people to disclose exactly what is happening. And so, I was also surprised. You can go to the next one, Lynn. You can keep going. That the largest response of things that people were concerned about was social stigma. And so that was one of the things that probably surprised me, just culturally knowing how far we've come, but also realizing this community still is plagued with the social stigma, and that they do not feel comfortable representing and expressing their identity in daily life. I think that was probably one of the most surprising things. And then other than that, resources in our community that are LGBT friendly. There was actually a pretty positive response on a scale of 4 to 1 to 5 48% of the respondents, which was 46 respondents, actually said that there is support that are LGBTQ friendly. And so if we keep going, we may learn that that number may balance out, that they're not, or even if we went down to and talked about medical providers, that that also might change. And then the biggest things that people talked about regarding what would be beneficial, social events, mental health access, healthcare resources, and we definitely heard about that. And the actual medical care at our main medical clinic, several people disclosed that it's not necessarily friendly for people from this from the LGBT community. And then also resources and training for children and families, also, and gender neutral bathrooms. And then also places that are intersectional, so where you can just not be with one aspect of who you are, but thinking about your whole self. And then also updating a list of providers, because they think that a lot of the resources are out of date. And so this is something that's constant that I think that happens even with 211 when the organization does closes or maybe the provider has changed or moved. That's something to think about. And then also actually gay-owned businesses. I'm not sure if you all have heard about the new coffee shop, Good Judy's. Okay. So, okay. And so the thing is like someone said, like there wasn't coffee shops, but Good Judy's also closes like at 4 p.m. So maybe just some advocacy or support on what does that look like to increase those hours so that it could be safer spaces, but more inclusive spaces. And then also 91% of the survey respondents stated that they are aware of community organization and events, and two people said no. And so I'm wondering who those people are. Are they new to the community, or do they just kind of, you know, are just at home or not connected to the community? And what we also learned was the support is really connected more to friends versus a family. So kind of a new friend is happening, and there are some people who would be willing to be contacted for additional presentations, but then there's some people that say no thank you. And that's okay too. And so this was our first start, but I think one of the things that I have seen in my field is you can raise flags, put flags on, but that still does not necessarily make you welcoming or a safe space. And so safe space is connected to people, not necessarily places always. And so when we get people in there that are actually safe, people that are actually inclusive, and people, then you do have safe and inclusive spaces. It's connected to the culture and the attitudes and values of people. And so just being nice is no longer good enough. You have to actually think of people as humans and humanity and thinking about it a bit more. And so that's a lot of deeper work that I've done over the years. Just challenging people not just to be nice and just to display things, but actually begin really thinking about how do they begin to shift their values and go on a journey to cultural competency. Any questions?
I have a quick question. So I think you said you had 105 responses thus far. Okay, 104 responses. How did you get your survey into people's hands?
How did I? That's a good question. What we did was we sent them to organizational leaders, and then we also used our own personal connections. And we, I did inbox on Facebook, you know, cause, my page isn't public, but I wanted to make sure that, I protected the identity of some people so that they can make sure that they feel a level of sense of safety knowing that I work for county government.
That was a very good question, Jane. It was also my question. I guess just a comment from my conversations with Lynn. My understanding is like this is like by far like the most responses we've ever gotten to a survey like this.
Ever.
Like how much?
So, yeah, like I don't know. So I think about like we've done a couple of surveys before. We've gotten maybe 30 responses back when we've done anonymous surveys before. But this was an overwhelming, like, I think we expected like 50. But to get like 104 and it's still going, I'm going to leave it alone. I'm going to keep it open probably another month. But I think we're also in a community response for public health. To think about like public health issues, this data that is being provided, I think we can share it systematically so that we can begin to think about some things differently. Because everyone is with us. We all here together, even though people are trying to erase us, we're not going anywhere.
Well, I think one of the things that has really come to me this evening is, and I'm sure, again, I'm going to pick on Dr. John again, how we have a community that doesn't feel supported in our medical system here in Champaign-Urbana. And I don't know how we fix that. I think, obviously, our agencies are trying to empower, you know, their clients, they're trying to support their clients, whether it be in the ER or whatever. And maybe it just goes back to we all building a culture of that's not acceptable. But it's just very disheartening to me. You know, and again, as far as like mental health care and stuff like that, that's of every gender, every race. You know, we don't have enough mental health care in this community, but it is really hard if you're saying, hey, I want someone who is affirming, or maybe someone who does look like me or whatever. I mean, and it shouldn't be that hard.
So, Jane, I'm going to agree that there are not enough mental health providers that are culturally responsive. Because if you look like in Psychology Today and just do a listing of the mental health professionals that actually reside here, we have an abundance, like way more than I thought. However, they don't all take Medicaid. They do not all take certain, like different insurance. And they're also not always culturally responsive to Black and Brown people. They don't have the language access services for people that do not speak English. Nor do they are they gender affirming and allyship to the LGBT community. And so I don't think that we do not have enough culturally responsive mental health providers here. I want to be very clear about that because Champaign-Urbana is very resource rich. There is a very explicit of who should be served. And that is very clear in our community.
I'm sorry to say none of this surprises me because I've spent 44 years fighting for a son with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And finally, a doctor friend said to me, but doctors have the same prejudices that the rest of the community does. And then that got much clearer to me what my how to fight my battles. Mm-hmm. But many wonderful providers.
Many wonderful people.
But you had to realize that and not imagine that a profession brings with it
bias,
a set of moral principles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially when you add the lack of taking Medicaid issue. I mean, I'm still I've heard that reflected in almost everything, every different presentation tonight. And it's something I've been very keenly aware of. And I recognize there are barriers to getting in with Medicaid. There are barriers that Medicaid has for providers, but for social workers, it is our ethical imperative. It shouldn't be a question, but I'm still trying to figure out what can we do to potentially help with that? So that's just an observation. I know we have a few more resources, and then I kind of want to open it up to everyone. Lynn, would you be willing to share the other information that you provided?
So, thank you, Chandra. Sorry, I'm sitting over here so that I can kind of ride the cameras, but it's the cameras. They're no, the it's a really long and boring story. So, but trust me, I am not the AV tech I thought I was at 5:30. So, all right. There are just a few more items in the packet. This is, Chandra's right. We sent out the survey to our personal networks, and that was a real journey for me because I'm 63 years old. So as I went through my network, I realized how many people have passed. So I have very few gay men friends who lived as long as I have, and a lot of them, it was during the height of AIDS that I lost those people. It was really a journey just trying to find people to say, you know. So anyway, sorry for oversharing, but I got some feedback from some of the people that I sent the survey to that I thought you should see. They gave me permission to share it anonymously. It touches on two things. That one is from a couple of allies and an accomplice who said, we have no business filling out this survey, even though we were invited to. And there's a nice explanation of why the person declined to fill it out. I thought that was really cool to see. The second is, we've just been touching on it, the intersectionality with disability. This is a big part of what we're doing is disability access as well. So I wasn't surprised to see these comments, but I thought they were quite rich and worth sharing as much as the person was willing to allow, which ended up being quite a bit. And then finally, they were really appreciative that anyone would ask them. And I thought, we need to know that too. We need to see that people don't ask very often and how important it is to ask and allow the answer, even if the answer is uncomfortable. So that's the first item. Do you have any questions about that one before I go to the next? I can be really quick with the other two.
I don't have any questions, but I think it's very important. So thank you for sharing that additional information.
Ready for the next?
Yes.
All right. The next thing is people heard about this. It happened really quick. The federal government chose to discontinue funding for the LGBTQIA+ specific helpline among the 988 crisis lines, which we've spent the last 6 years talking about that and standing up these services that really haven't even fully implemented or really sunk in. So federal government chose to stop funding that one. And then the state of Illinois rushed in, and I'm here to say I don't
acknowledge very often great things that the state of Illinois is doing, but they jumped in fast to say, we will continue to fund it in Illinois. And I thought that was important to include both. So there's the state jumping in to say, okay, we'll do it. So it's youth specific. So it's still really great, really important. The other bit, I mean, I just wanted everybody to know that. I learned something else from the director of the state's new behavioral health and recovery department, which was that they, just 2 days before we had this conversation, he announced that the state is suing the federal government over the executive order which prohibits public funding that could be used by undocumented immigrants. And so I don't know what's happened with that lawsuit, but I would like to hear about other similar lawsuits by the state of Illinois. Maybe they'll come. And thank you for the information about that you shared earlier. So the final thing is, like, just if we can have any good news. This index is, I think the website is listed in the agenda of this packet. If you get the electronic version, you can link into this. This whole map project is pretty interesting. It goes pretty deep into these indices. But Illinois is one of the most high rated for equality for LGBTQIA plus people, and some of the measures have to do with policy. So that seemed like a nice way to end the packet, even though it doesn't change the seriousness of the other issues that we've discussed tonight. Okay.
My mic didn't come on. Thank you very much, Lynn, for sharing that with us. So I guess the next item on the agenda is public participation agency input, which I'll still do at the end, but the study session part isn't over. So I was trying to figure out, like, questions I can kind of ask everyone, and I'll come up with some if I need to, but I wanted to give, you know, we have a lot of community members here with us tonight and other agency representatives. And I just wanted to give anybody who is in the audience an opportunity to come up and share anything else, anything you want to share. So concern, you know, things you've experienced, concerns you have, ideas you have, anything is fair game. I kind of just see it as like an open opportunity to talk and us have a conversation. Board also will, you know, has opportunity to make additional comments and share their thoughts. So the podium with multiple microphones, hopefully that are all still working, is open for anybody who wants to come forward and say anything.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm Nathan Alexander, and I'm the chair of the LGBTQ homeless work group for the Continuum of Care locally. I just wanted to mention at first, I'm very appreciative of how much housing was a discussion and access to resources. Within the past year, we had about a 27% increase in those that were HUD-defined houseless, and the year prior to that, it was around 30%. So the point in time count is the annual count where we assess that. And so we're seeing these numbers increase. We're seeing people come to this area. And then I also serve as vice chair to the university YMCA. And I do want to emphasize the interactions between immigrant communities and LGBTQ inclusion and the issues that undocumented and immigrants are having with this current situation.
Thank you so much. And I also want to make a mention that in October, we will be having a study session focused on immigrant and refugee mental health that I believe is the 29th of October. Anyone else would like to share?
And that can be board members too.
I would just say a few things from this experience, from listening to everybody. You know, obviously, as the mental health board, I always think about what we can do. And, you know, obviously, everyone acknowledges we have an abundance of resources in this county for mental health, and yet we still struggle to provide services that are, you know, quality care that is gender affirming for our community. And we fund agencies that provide mental health care, so they should be on the list of providers that are providing gender affirming care. There is absolutely no excuse. So, you know, that might be something they are not thinking about. And we need to make sure we make them think about it, like Rosecrans and Promise Healthcare. I mean, Promise Healthcare is doing a great job with access now, but this is something that they should, all their providers should be on this list. Obviously, it's something that I take to heart, of something I want to work on with my providers and in my practice and other, you know, maybe family medicine. Obviously, I'm pediatric, so maybe working with family medicine, trying to expand that at Carl, making sure that they're on the list. So that's something on my to-do list that I'm thinking about today. And also, I know for pediatrics, there was a long time we didn't understand why patients that were part of this community didn't feel welcome coming to pediatrics, because we're pediatricians and, like, we're hopefully super nice. And like you said, it's not enough just to be nice, but we have a lot of nursing staff that it wasn't trained on gender-affirming care and being LGBTQ friendly and saying things that were just very offensive, and parents and patients didn't tell us. And so we didn't know until someone told me, and then we try to make sure that we are actively training our staff. And we do have turnover in nursing assistants who room patients and do vaccines and everything, and those are probably the ones that interact with the patients the most. And if that's your front line and that's your first experience coming into the office, and that is already setting the tone for the rest of the visit, that's very negative. And obviously then you wouldn't want to come back, even if the doctor or provider is providing quality care. So, you know, that's something that I will take to heart and try to make sure we work on as in our field. But I think something that we can do as a mental health board is making sure that bigger agencies that are providing mental health healthcare resources that we are funding are also doing the same thing, and making sure they're actively taking a role in including this as part of their mission. So.
Thank you very much. I have also been thinking about that, like how we could help our requirements ensure that, or work to ensure that anyone we fund is affirming and truly so. But then like how to do that, figuring that out, I think is challenging. I also, I'm sitting here thinking, like, here are all of these services that should happen. Like this idea of the, like, having the space for someone for people, queer and trans people, to just come and be. As the board, we can't start that space. But if someone came to us and said, we'd like funding to start that space, that's something we could consider. We can think about how we can adjust priorities or our strategic plan to really focus on some of these things. But I also hope that this study session provides an opportunity for anybody who's listening to hear, like, hey, this is a board that cares about this. We can come to them with our idea, and maybe they'll give us money. That's what we're here for. So I wanted to say that, and then wanted to, you know, pass it back to anybody in the community or board who wants to share more.
May I say something?
Yes, and our staff as well.
All right, thank you. First, thank you to all of the presenters, the speakers today, for sharing the wealth of knowledge that you possess, the ongoing fight, and for just equality. My question is very basic, and it may piggyback off of what others have said, but you know, I have a chance to sit in on many councils and committees, and I often hear a lot of overlapping issues. And I just wonder, is there someone or bodies that are not here that should be here to hear what needs to be said, to understand what's really going on in the community? And this question is for anyone in front of me, so...
Sort of like maybe who should have been in the room tonight to listen.
So like agency reps from agencies that provide mental health care.
Yes, there are some online, which is good, but there could be more.
And maybe some of the hospitals and clinics.
Do we need our local politicians? Do we need... Okay.
That's an interesting... Thank you, Jane.
I just wanted to go back to what y'all were talking about earlier. We are already having trouble with some of the things, the values that this board explicitly advances. If an agency also receives federal funding, like there was a really important plan with clear action steps that was developed over time in this community using mental health board funds. It is not on the agency's website anymore because its focus was racial equity, and the agency has federal funding and they had to pull it down. I found it because we presented on it and I shared it with community partners who need to do some things about this issue really fast. But that's a clue to me that we could have some challenges with those organizations who have federal funding and are now not allowed to serve people who say they're undocumented or, right? That's already happening. And so I think we're going to run into barriers around what we're requiring and what the federal government is requiring against. So I appreciated your comments about those values, but I think we're already,
Can I come back and speak to that? Because I brought some of that up.
Yes.
Thanks. So again, I'm not an attorney. Don't play one on TV. The guidance that we have received, especially from our coalition, does support the interpretation that is more in line with you just can't use that federal money for those purposes, right? So that shouldn't mean, I think what we're seeing is a lot of places pre-complying, right? So I think in terms of what this body can do, can be helping to articulate, you know, if there is an opportunity to have an attorney weigh in, right? Where is that line? Is the interpretation that this just applies to those specific grants? Because the executive orders are for the federal workforce. And I think often it gets taken as directives for funding recipients. So having that distinction and having someone with legal expertise weigh in and help funded agencies understand. So if we do receive federal funding, what does that mean for our values and for our CCMHB funding, right? I think that's something where, you know, the county could help in terms of clarifying things for agencies. And I think also encouraging, you know, assuming that more restrictive interpretation is correct, if it is, also encouraging agencies to not pre-comply, right? Because I think that's where we're seeing people out of fear, right? Especially if you are heavily federally funded, it is very scary to think about losing your ability to serve anybody. But also thinking about, you know, the organizations in this community are here to serve the most vulnerable members of our community. If we're not doing that, how are we prioritizing the use of funds in this community? I also do want to kind of echo what was already shared in terms of what is unusual about this board is, you know, we are very fortunate that we do receive funding from multiple government offices, multiple local funding sources. We're always looking for new opportunities. That's why we were looking at that federal grant. This is the only body that's had this, is having this kind of study session, right? And like I put the date down for the one about serving immigrants in our community too. So some of it is maybe ensuring that that information is being shared with other entities that are providing funding to our community so that they understand like there were already barriers and it is harder now. Right. There are sources of funding that people do not have access to anymore. So as they are making decisions, too, that they're keeping in mind, you know, where are the actual gaps versus maybe that's something that somebody could apply for, you know, from another source if they don't have those restrictions.
So just to kind of let you know, just from my position, many people have asked me directly, is my job in jeopardy? Because my job literally looks at racial disparities. I look at it like I've lived it. And so, and because of who I am, just living as a Black woman in the world, I've always thought ahead of it. And so, which is why we took a position really of looking at cultural competence instead of switching a lot of our language to DEI, because the family culture, individual culture touches the hearts of every single human. And even though there are the class standards that we definitely utilize and definitely measure and work with organizations, when you focus on family culture, that's pretty much a universal piece. And I've had to do a lot of education with people that were white to say, you all do have a culture. It's a culture that you have, and it's not anything that's better than or less than or any of that. But learning to get people to honor who they are, not necessarily the jobs they do. And so that was one clear thing that the Mental Health Board has taken a stance on, was cultural competence from the very beginning. And I've been doing this work for about 15 years. So because cultural competency is never going to go away, because when it's all boiled down to it, all of us want to be served based on our own beliefs, based on our values, and based on who we are. And we all should have quality service that is easily understood. Like, I don't think we get ready to uproot that and getting ready to. So when you begin to look about name changes or wordsmithing, really begin to think about what is it that you really want, and being very explicit that really is inclusive language that speaks to the culture of the people you're serving. And what I did find is that that's really hard for a lot of people, because you are going a step different, because you're not just looking at them saying, okay, because you're this, this, and this. It's trying to really break through and becoming responsive to that person's culture and who they are. So the Mental Health Board has been ahead of the game for a very long time. And several organizations, as I've said, doing work with people for all these years, we're on a journey where there are dark sides, there are pits, there are curves, and it's some parts that are dangerous. We're in a dangerous time right now. And so there's support. I am here to help. I've been paying attention. I've read the executive order connected to changing all of these things. I've decided to get familiar with it so that I could know exactly how to support organizations. The thing that is really disheartening is the care that they're taking away from people that do not align with the values of the current administration, and that's very disheartening.
Well said. Another thing I was thinking, you know, it sounds like a few of us have homework, you know, things that we want to do, people we want to reach out to. I like the suggestion of maybe we need to invite more agencies to come to the next study session, because a lot of the agencies may not do direct, you know, immigration things, but they have clients that overlaps. And so I don't know if that is something that, you know, maybe our staff and Lynn can invite some of these agencies, but I'd almost go so far to say, hey, Molly, you're a good writer. I think whether it come from our staff or from you and I think we need to send some notes to some of our, you know, politicians and be like, hey, our eyes were opened. You might want to come spend a couple hours with us and hear what's going on in your district, in your town, whatever. So, I'll be quiet now, but that was something that popped in my head. And if anyone has any thoughts of who we need to invite or whatever, let's send them through Lynn or whatever and see who shows up.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I've certainly had, you know, people who are interested in running for office or are running for office reach out and ask things, but they're not here. Like, have they listened? Have they ever seen a mental health board meeting? Have they ever listened to these conversations? So hopefully that will change. Yeah.
Just to say, the next study session is actually in September. And I think everybody needs to come to that, because it is focused on people with intellectual and developmental disabilities who actually do happen to sometimes be queer people and sometimes trans and sometimes Black. And the systems really do exclude people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And I so appreciated my friend's extensive comments on the ways that they are excluded because of their disabilities. And so I think sometimes it's not a very well attended study session because people aren't super worried about IDD, but we should be. So I just wanted to shout out for that one.
Another thing you said who was missing, I think, are faith-based leaders and natural supports. And when I say that, there are natural supports that are not 501c3, but they are providing support to our community. So they're not necessarily a recognized organization, but they're definitely organized. They're movements. They're building coalitions that oftentimes are providing support to our communities, but they're getting private dollars from people, but also could utilize the information that we're given to help them connect to different supports and different services. So those are some people that might be missing as well. Natural supports, like youth groups.
Yes. Thank you. Daria, would you like to share?
Thanks. I didn't know how to get involved, so I just came and sat up here. One of the things we've talked a lot about, and I was going to mention this because I didn't put it in the slides, but I remember now, we've talked a lot about how to help people live healthy and happy lives, but we haven't talked about how to support people while they're dying and help them with death with dignity. We have lost two clients this past year, and right now we have a client in the hospital who is terminal. And we don't think about something until we need to. We never thought in our jobs we'd have to help someone through the dying process, help them make these decisions because they don't have any other supports. So I just wanted to make this, you know, on your radar, because it's just something we don't think about a lot. When people come here and they have no one, or they come here because they left a family that wasn't supportive, who sits by them? And it's us. We will do it. It's We didn't think it was going to be part of the job because we didn't want it to be 40 years later, and we're still burying folks. But it is, and we will continue doing it. But I just also wanted to make that known. AIDS still kills. And unfortunately, we have seen it very frequently this past year. That's it.
Thank you for making that really, really important reminder. Does anyone else want to come forward and share?
I just want to echo the comment about people not in the room, you know, our natural supports, our community members that are not represented organizations. I think it's just really important to kind of drive home this point that queer people exist in every organization, in every faith community, in every family, in every school. And it's not something that you can dance around. And there are a lot of people who don't have the access to the education. And that's where we as an organization are happy to step in. And I think the conversations we've had around like the pre-compliance issue, we've had a lot of those conversations in the last 8 months. A lot of really distraught organizations who have come to us and said, well, I had to take my pronouns out of our name because we're going to lose funding and shut everything down. And that's a terrible position to be in. Our hospital systems right now, I do not envy them in any way because they're losing access to gender-affirming care, and it's not entirely the system's fault, you know? Do you have to choose this or do you have to choose shutting down completely? We're never going to tell you to shut down completely. But I think there are conversations that we as organizations who are very much engaged in this work can have around, like, you know, I know, like, the homeless subgroup that we've talked a lot about. I've talked with both shelters around, like, okay, HUD funding, you can't put that someone's trans, right? Like, you can't, you're at risk if you do that. But, and I know nobody wants to do more paperwork, least of all me, but there are ways that you can do the intake process and put things in people's files or have things recorded so that people are still getting the support and you are still complying with these ridiculous federal orders. So I think, you know, again, the question about who should be in this room, everybody should be in this room. And I echo the fact that our legislators and our leaders, both at the local, state, and federal level, should be in these conversations, and they are often not. And that's disappointing in a lot of ways. But I think, you know, people really need to understand that you do not have to reinvent the wheel. There are organizations on the ground doing it, and we are happy to provide that consult or provide that education. You know, I think the point about walking into healthcare systems and doctors, a lot of times, administrators, a lot of times, they'll get this education, but nursing staff, admin staff, staff on the ground, the people that you are going to interact with nine times more than anybody else in that system are not necessarily getting that education. And so we exist to do that. And, you know, whether it's people in this room now or people who are getting CCMHP funding or people who are, you know, not 501c3s, we really want people to understand that, like, we are here to provide that. And cost is never going to be a barrier. You know, if you have a little bit of money to spend on training, great, please do. We're super small. But if you can't, I'll come do it for free. We told police stations, I'll come in and do a 2 a.m. training for your night staff, whatever it takes, because education is the key to ending some of this social stigma.
Thank you so much for that.
Sorry.
Please don't apologize. We are very glad to hear from you.
The one other addition I might add is think about how data is being collected and whether or not it's required. We're entering an era where data collection could be viewed, particularly from people needing services, as a risk factor. So whether or not there's ways that as a board you can alter how data is collected or reported or aggregated, there might be ways that you could decrease either realized or perceived risk while still trying to do data-guided services.
Thank you. there any final comments? Well, we have had a very good and thorough and long discussion, and I thank all of you for being here through it and sharing so much important information and insights and really, really difficult things. So awkwardly, we will move on to public participation agency input. Even though this has been like a whole public participation piece, if there's anybody else who wants to share anything with the board, you can come forward or raise your hand in the Zoom and do so. This is kind of the last chance for the evening. All right, no one on Zoom, no one in person, so we will move on to board announcements and input. Are there any announcements or input from the board? I will make one announcement that our Dr. John Paul Joachim was named to the Central Illinois 40 Under 40 recently, so he will be awarded that in October. We're very proud of him. Any other announcements? All right, I see no point in belaboring that. So our last item on the agenda is to adjourn, but I will just do a little preview of what's coming next, because we will have, in September and October, we will have a meeting and a study session each month. So our next meeting is September 17th, and then September 24th is our study session around intellectual and developmental disability. And then in October, our meeting is the 22nd, and our study session on immigrant and refugee mental health is the 29th. And all of them are at 5:45 p.m. on Wednesdays in this room in the Bennett Administrative Center. So with that, we will adjourn. Thank you very much for being here.
Recording stopped.
Thank you so much for all you've shared today. My name is Jesse Ryan with Champaign County Regional Planning Commission.
Thank you for all that you all do.
Thank you all for
could not do it without it all of these. It really does.
It really does. But I know, I was just like, I don't want to be repetitive.
We don't work in a vacuum.
When they asked, I was like, how's that? Oh, also, like,